Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, liberty-loving patriot. Welcome to the Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne Show. Please be sure to tune in Sunday nights from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, to discuss current events, news, and political opinion with Lucid Libertarian flair. Be prepared, folks. We often go into an optional extended third hour. This show advocates for liberty, freedom, our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and limited government, while speaking against corporate and government corruption, tyranny, and the globalist Great Reset agenda that undermines our precious American sovereignty. Discussions here are unscripted and free-flowing, so sometimes conversations wander off in unpredictable directions. Would you like to call in and share your thoughts and be part of the conversation? The number is 563-999-3698. Again, that is 563-999-3698. Press number 1 and you'll be added to the queue. Please also like and follow my Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne page on Facebook. You can help me battle their freedom-loathing censorship by visiting my page regularly, along with reacting, commenting, and sharing my posts. Thank you so much for listening, but please sit tight and don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a few minutes to kick off the show.
NWCR Radio has been on the air since 2006 and with Conservative Nation Media since 2013. Now, NWCR continues as the owner of CNM with the news that the lamestream lying liberal media chooses not to tell you because the truth has nothing to do with the agenda that they are all pushing. We will tell the truth no matter what the liberal left has to say about it or what the truth is. Being banned off of YouTube for telling the truth with my updates and off of Facebook several times, we have our badges of honor that we keep pushing the envelope for on our show. My co-host, Lucid Libertarian Lorianne, and I, along with my band of callers, have great shows with great information for America on each episode. We are NWCR Radio, Friday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio through Conservative Nation Media, where America always wins.
Do our taxes and we're going to do them right, cause the IRS is coming and they're brimming for a fight.
Oh, we're gonna do our taxes and I think we'd all agree that doing our taxes yearly is what keeps us safe and free.
You're a suck up, huh? Preston. Oh, they're gonna do their taxes, but I think I'm gonna pass. The taxman can just take this form and shove it up his ass.
Hey kids, let's take a look at how wisely the government spends our money. All right, all together now.
Oh, we're going to do our taxes even though we'd rather not.
If you don't,
the government is going to audit you. And they're going to raid your records, and every aspect of your life is going to be put under a microscope by a poorly paid bureaucrat with nothing to lose. Every secret you've ever had, Every lie you've ever told, every nefarious affair you've found yourself in is going to be ripped from the depths and exposed for all to see. Your friends and your family will turn their backs in shame as they see you debased by the system they so thoroughly support with their taxable income. And when that happens, oh, when that happens, there really is only one thing left in store. They'll lock you up to rot.
But we're gonna do our taxes even though it makes us hell. But we've got to do them anyway, so I guess we might as well.
Make them pay 4 months of earnings.
Oh, that's a good one.
Have them look for lost receipts.
Ooh, I like it.
They'll have about as much fun as their last colonoscopy. People everywhere will get ripped off. The paper version of the Apple Watch. And we'll dance all night. It's the best code ever. Some folks pay a lot. Others, they pay never, and you'll get tax breaks. If you're really clever, it'll take so long. It's the best code ever. They'll be like, oh, oh, no. We'll be like, yes, yes, yes. We'll be like, oh.
You may have heard that all your info on our system can be hacked with ease.
You know it's true.
Yeah. But rest assured if they don't get them, in the care of folks like these.
Yes, historians will all agree, among the greatest works in history. And we'll dance all night. It's the best code ever. Some folks pay a lot, others they pay never. And if you don't comply, you'll go to jail. However, why would you not buy? It's the best code ever. They'd be like, oh, oh, no. We'd be like, yes, yes, yes. They'd be like, oh, oh, no. We'd be like, yes, yes, yes. They'd be like, oh, oh, no.
Well, hello, hello out there, all of you liberty-loving people out there. You are tuned in to the Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne show. I am your host, obviously, Lorianne. Thank you so much for making your way here. I have a very special guest coming back for the fourth time. So I guess people might be able to guess that I'm a kind of big fan of Dave Champion, a.k.a. Dr. Reality, and hopefully he has agreed to come back for a round four because he enjoyed the past three times he's been on the show. We've had awesome conversations, so I'm really excited to have him back again for a fourth time. I know a couple of my listeners have asked me a few times when I'm going to have him on my show again. So here we are. And I do see that he's in the switchboard ready to go, and I'll bring him on here shortly. I really want to encourage everybody to follow him on Rumble. I have a link to his Rumble channel in the show description if you're viewing the webpage for today's show. Follow him on Rumble. I can tell you, I mean, there are a lot of podcasts out there. There are a lot of videos. I know there's a lot of TikTok addicts out there that will spend hours and hours and hours watching videos that do them absolutely no good and are pretty much a waste of time. I can guarantee you that if you follow Dave Champion on Rumble and start investing some of your time watching his videos, then it will be time well spent for you. And, of course, he is the author of Income Tax Shattering the Myth. So I very much encourage you to go to drreality.news, drreality.news, and check out his book, get it and read it. Very good book. And he dispels a lot of the propaganda and myths
about the income tax and who it applies to and who it doesn't apply to, which guess what is most Americans, as he will say, and very enlightening. So like I said, you know, follow him on Rumble. He talks more about more topics than just the income tax, but it is one of his focuses. On his website, you can read up about him. Really short synopsis. He's a physiologist. He has a doctoral degree in political philosophy. He has an extensive background in legal studies. He's served as a legal consultant on state and federal regulatory matters and constitutional law advisor. He's lectured on many subjects, including the U.S. Constitution, history, the proper limited application of the income tax, government relations, and human psychology, and physiology, I mean. He's a former martial arts instructor, firearms tactics and use of force instructor. He's a former Army Ranger with a law enforcement background many, many moons ago. And now he's a business entrepreneur. So, you know, this guy is somebody that knows what he's talking about. He has spent an awful lot of time over many, many years so that he can speak with confidence about what he talks about. And he is very factual based. He doesn't tend to go down conspiracy road like I tend to. And in any case, so I am really, really happy to welcome him back. I'm going to go ahead and bring him on the line. And for you listeners out there, feel free to call in 563-999-3485. Again, that is 563-999-3485. And I, as usual, when I have a guest on, I like to have a good amount of one-on-one time with the guest without interruption. But I do intend to, during the last half hour or so of this live broadcast, right around 7:30-ish or so Pacific time, that'd be 10:30 Eastern time, that's when I want to open up the phone lines one by one to take anybody, any callers on that want to ask him a question or have a comment on anything that he said, and bring every, you know, bring people on one by one so everybody can have a turn and have a few minutes with him. And hopefully we'll get the phone lines lighting up with people with having some good questions and comments. So that being said, I am bringing Mr. Dave Champion on into the show. Welcome, welcome, welcome. How are you doing? Happy Sunday and happy pre-federal tax filing form day eve.
Hi, Lorianne. It's great to be back. Yeah, tomorrow is the, being April 15th, tomorrow is the real April Fool's Day, when 100 million Americans, individual Americans, and then Lord knows how many businesses, get fooled by the United States government into believing that they have to file tax returns and pay a percentage of their earnings over to the United States government. And the fact that it is 100 million citizens that have been completely and utterly fooled by the United States government. And they fool themselves because they just don't care to look into the truth. But 100 million of them are going to surrender their property to the government tomorrow because they're just too lazy to look at the law. It's crazy.
Well, you know, and I think it's beyond laziness, I think. It is so brainwashing. I mean, we are not taught in school to think in legalese. We are not taught to how to actually look up, read, and understand laws. I think it's like it melts our brains when a lot of people try to do it. I know I do. I don't like looking at a 50-page, you know, bill of legislation and trying to understand what it means. So there is a laziness factor involved, but I also think that it's just brain melting. And that's why we need people like Automatically Melt to try to understand this stuff, to come and talk to us in like real world language.
You know, I saw somebody put up a screenshot on one of the social media sites the other day. And it was instructions by the school district to students concerning how to conduct their research. And it said, when you're looking for material, when you go to .gov, you know you're getting credible information. When you go to anything else like .com, .news, .info, etc., those are sites where you may find disinformation. So here's the government telling mushy-headed students that the only site that they can rely on to tell the truth is .gov. Tell me that doesn't program young mushy minds so that as they move forward in life, well, the government is credible. Everybody else is not telling the truth. And, of course, it's exactly the opposite.
Isn't that very self-serving?
And the government lies all the time, and lies even when the truth would serve it well. But yet somehow they're programming kids to believe that .gov tells the truth, and pretty much anybody else, that's where you're going to find the disinformation. That's revoltingly backwards. That's 180 degrees away from reality.
I absolutely agree. I think probably one of the most prominent government .gov websites there is that feeds nothing but propaganda is whitehouse.gov. I don't think that we can actually rely on anything that website says.
Yeah, it's absurd. Yeah, unless something is very, very non-controversial, sort of a plain vanilla subject that nobody has any angst about in one direction or another. Other than that, you can pretty much be assured that government websites are not going to tell you the facts.
100% right. 100%. You did a really good interview about a week ago that I got done watching, and you got really into like some of these definitions of all these terms, in regard to the income tax. Like, what does employee really mean? What does wages actually, and income actually mean? What does who's required for withholding actually mean? How is it defined? How is a person defined? And these terms that are thrown around, there's what we think they mean in normal language, but they're very significant when you're looking at what laws actually say and how they actually define them. I would like you to maybe just say a few words on that. Like, what are the biggest points on with those kinds of terms that you would like to make for listeners?
Number one point, as you're reading through law, if you read law and presume that you know what the words mean that you are reading because you are intelligent and you have read the dictionary and you know what those words mean, you are very, very likely to take away from reading that law a completely inaccurate view of what that law pertains to, because the Supreme Court has said that legislatures, not just Congress, any of the state, any legislature, is free to define words in whatever way they want. So we'll use Congress as an example, since we're almost certainly going to talk about income tax tonight. Congress is free to take a word we all believe we understand. You could ask 100 people, and you get essentially the same definition for the word. Congress is free to take that word and define it differently. And the only restriction that the Supreme Court has placed on that practice is that Congress make available somewhere in what you're reading how they've redefined the word. Now, I should say how they've defined the word. They've only redefined it in terms of the ordinary American thinking it means what it means in Webster's. In that sense, it's been redefined. But the Supreme Court has said that Congress has the right to craft a definition of a word we think we know the meaning of in order to achieve Congress's objectives. And as somebody who spent 25 years studying law, I get it. As somebody who understands that my fellow citizens have no clue how law operates, it's deceptive as hell. And I don't really have a problem with the practice. If there was some sort of, like after every section, there was a note in the parentheses and said, words in this section may not mean what you think they mean in the English dictionary. See definition section at page what have you. If there was that sort of full disclosure, I wouldn't necessarily object. But the problem is that the definitions are sometimes literally, I'm not being facetious, hundreds and hundreds of pages away from where this word is used that's been redefined by Congress. So somebody's reading through it. You happen to mention the word employee. Somebody's reading through a statute, and they see the word employee. Well, gosh, again, you can line 100 Americans up and ask them what the definition of employee is, and you get essentially 100 people giving you the same response. And that's not remotely what it means in U.S. law. So it's a problem, and I hope I'm clear. If people understood that they must, whatever they read a law, I don't care whether it's something pertaining to the DMV, something pertaining to property rights, I don't care whether it's the income tax, when you read the statute, any statute, and you go, okay, I get it, that makes perfect sense to me, your understanding is probably incorrect if you didn't go to the definition section and see how words that are commonly used in English have been redefined by the legislature for that specific law.
Which you bring up a good point. Definitions for the same word, depending on the type of law that it's written. You know, so the definition for employee for tax code can be one definition, but then there can be completely other legislation not having to do with taxes that defines employee completely differently. So that's another part of the confusion is, you know, and then like you said, they don't say, you know, go to section this and this and this and that and that and that to read the definition of this. It's like we're supposed to just intuitively know where to go to look up where that definition was originally, you know, how many decades ago that it was defined, right? And so that's part of the problem, and that's, I think, deliberately set up that way to be so confusing so that the average person finds it almost impossible to understand.
Well, certainly gives lawyers a lot of power because they are taught that in law school. They understand to go look at the definition section where the other 333 million Americans don't know to do that. I'll tell you what the problem is. Years ago, I was at the Maine Los Angeles County Law Library doing some research, and there's a book for legal professionals, and it's called succinctly Words and Phrases. I looked up the word resident in Words and Phrases, and it said that the word resident, depending on where and how it's used, has 45 different meanings for the same word. We talked about employee in the we talked about employee as used in the Internal Revenue Code. Well, we mentioned it a moment ago. I have found thus far 8 different definitions for the word employee as used in the tax code. There may be more. I've stumbled across 8 of them. So that gives you an example, you know, especially if somebody's looking at a matter that's personal to them, something like, say, payroll withholding. And it says payroll withholding is to be done from the employee. So the average Joe who's an auto mechanic or works at Walmart or is a receptionist at a doctor's office, they're going to read that, and absent seeing how Congress has redefined that word for the purpose of payroll withholding, they're going to say, oh, yeah, I was told that it doesn't actually apply to me, so But look, I just read. It does. Payroll withholding is to be done upon employees. That's me. Okay, it's settled. These people who are telling me it does not apply to me, they're obviously full of shit because it says right here. They have no idea what the word employee means that they just read. And that is a huge part. By no means is it exclusive, the only element of the scam concerning income tax, but it is a huge tool that Congress and the Secretary of the Treasury have used for the last 111 years to fool the American people about income tax.
And it's a very profitable scam, very much so, obviously. They're raking in all this dough. And I guess, you know, one of the things that we've talked about before, but for those that might be listening that haven't had, you know, listened to you a whole lot, you've talked a lot about who the income tax actually applies to. And there's three categories. Will you give a brief summary on the three categories of people that by law that you've researched that the income tax actually applies to?
Sure. Before I cite them, since you said the, you know, that I did a fair amount of, I think I want your audience to know that I'm 30 years into this now, and I researched the law for 17 years before I published Income Tax Shattering the Myths. So there's no question mark about any of the things I'm going to mention to you. And that can be verified by the tens of thousands of people who've read Income Tax Shattering the Myths. And frankly, anyone who listens to this broadcast and thinks, you know, I think Mr. Champion's full of it. All they have to do to know otherwise is simply read Income Tax Shattering the Myths. They'll close the final page and they'll say, wow, I was wrong. He was right. And I don't say that in any sort of an ego sense. I say that because I want people to have confidence in the subject that we're talking about. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. And you're really, really good in your book about citing, like, look for yourself. Don't just take my word for it. Here's where you go. You know,
yes.
Here's the section to look up. Read it on your own, you know. You'll see that I'm not just, you know, making this stuff out of thin air.
In both of my books, I say, please do not take my word for anything. Do your own research. Look it up. In the case of Income Tax Shatter, there is an extensive index, and there's a table of authorities that has all the court cases and all the citations of law. So it is a scholarly work that anybody can follow along. Nobody has to take my word for anything. Now, with that said, what you refer to as the three categories, in law, just because I prefer to be precise, in law, there are three classes of persons. That's a fancy legal term for category. There are three classes of persons upon whom Congress has imposed the income tax. Then I'm going to tell you a fourth one that's been made liable. So the first of the three that the tax has been imposed upon is non-resident aliens with U.S. source income. The second is foreign corporations with U.S. source income. The third is U.S. citizens residing abroad with foreign earned income. And there is a fourth class upon whom the tax has not been imposed, but has actually been made liable for the tax, and that is U.S. citizens or residents who withhold the U.S. income tax from U.S. source income before they send it offshore to its foreign owner. So the example I often give of that fourth category is, let's say, a multimillionaire in Brazil. He sends an investment firm in the United States several million dollars to invest in the U.S. stock market. And so the investment firm buys up a bunch of shares of Apple on his behalf. Apple pays out dividends, but Apple doesn't send the dividends to the Brazilian gentleman. Apple sends the dividends to the investment firm, and the investment firm then sends them, if it's the wish of the Brazilian business person, they will then send that that U.S. source income in the form of dividends, in this example, to the Brazilian owner. Now, the way U.S. income tax law works, Apple is a U.S. source. So when we talk about non-resident aliens with U.S. source income, Apple being the origin of the income is the U.S. source. But it's paid to a U.S. investment firm. That U.S. investment firm, before it can send that money on to the Brazilian, which means crossing the U.S. border, leaving the U.S., they are required under law to withhold the U.S. income tax that the Brazilian gentleman owes. Once they've withheld that tax, they become liable to file a return and pay it over to the United States government. So while the tax was not imposed on the investment firm like it was on the three classes, the investment firm has nevertheless been made liable to pay the tax for the gentleman upon whom the tax was imposed. Did I express that clearly?
You absolutely did. And I think, wouldn't that person equate to being like an agent? They're an agent acting on behalf of.
Yes, and let me add to that, if I may. In the tax code, that's referred to as a U.S. person. Now, U.S. person is used throughout federal law, and it means different things in different areas of law. So we have to be very clear about what U.S. person means in reference to the income tax. In reference to the income tax, a U.S. person is a U.S. citizen or a domestic corporation that is involved in the flow of U.S. income, U.S. source income, from its origin to its foreign owner. So in the example we just gave, the U.S. investment firm would be a, quote, U.S. person. Now, this is a very confusing term for Americans. And none of this is on accident, by the way. The fact that you know, the different definitions, people are confused about what U.S. person, none of this is by accident. This is completely designed from the ground up to fool the American people so the government can commit what it has been committing and continues to commit, the largest financial crime in world history. So the reason I say U.S. person is confusing for ordinary Americans is Americans on the whole, generalizing, tend to be, you know, patriotic people. You know, they love their country, and many of them have served in the military, and they consider themselves, you know, American to the core, so to speak. So when they're reading through law and they come across U.S. person, they say, hell yeah, I'm a U.S. person. You bet your ass I'm a U.S. person. Because in their way of thinking, because they don't imagine that the law is as convoluted and contrived as it is. They think you read it through just like you'd read, I don't know, Harry Potter, right? It just means what it says. So they read through it and they see U.S. person. So they see that a U.S. person is required to do this and such. So they say, well, all right then, since I'm a U.S. person, I'm required to do this and such, and I better get on with it, or I'm a lawbreaker, I'm a scofflaw. They have no idea what U.S. person actually means in tax law. You know, 999,999 out of a million Americans who read U.S. person, they have no idea what it means. So if a U.S. person is commanded in law to do this and that, the average American goes, oh, I don't want to get in trouble with the IRS. I got to go do that. Because they don't know any better. Because I don't mean to be pejorative. They haven't taken the time to learn about the law. So when they bump into the law, they don't know what the hell it means. And that's really a shame. There should be a class in, I don't know, at least two semesters in every high school in America that teaches young Americans the kind of things I talk about in income tax shadowness. And by that, I mean the statutory rules of construction and how regulations are to be interpreted and what definition, how the legislatures treat definitions. There's a lot on a much going up to the 35,000 foot level without specific examples. Just the bottom line, the law rarely means what people think it means when they read it as ordinary English, which is oftentimes how it reads. There's no tip-off that it has a contrary meaning. So without a tip-off, ordinary good-hearted Americans think, well, it means what it says. That's rarely the case when it comes to law. It rarely means what it says.
Deliberately, and that's part of the scam.
Yeah.
You know, and that brings me to things like here in Oregon, certain legislation can go up directly to the voters as a measure, you know, and we'll vote on the measure. And, of course, that measure, they have to, you know, display the actual text of the legislation. And the problem with that is a lot of that legislation, when you read through it, goes, okay, you know, we're defining this and this and this and that according to ORS statute, blah, 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 this. We're going to define this according to, or, you know, Oregon statute, blah, 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 that. But the voters don't actually take those extra steps to look up those statutes and their definitions so that they understand what the measure or the text of the measure that they're voting on actually means. And problems. Like, I know that I really do want to hit up a little bit later in the show the measure 110 that Oregon passed decriminalizing drugs. And then, of course, measure 114, the gun control legislation. Those are two topics that I definitely want to hit up with you. But that's where we get into these problems, is because there is so much effort involved in understanding the legislation that they're actually voting on. They can't just read what that text says. And like you said, they'll read it thinking that it means one thing because that's, you know, these terms, you know, they think that they're self-evident, but they're actually not. And so, yeah, so in order to really understand what they're voting on, it's like you got to spend hours looking up all of these different statutes to find out how it's defined and how it pertains to that particular piece of legislation, and then actually be able to confidently vote for or against it.
Yeah, it's disturbing. And I want to say that, how can I phrase this? This is not a mystery. I know it. You know it. Lots of other people know it, at least in the broad outline. And more often than not, what I see is people just don't feel that it's worth taking their time. They're saying, look, I got my kids, you know, softball game. I've got to take my daughter to the high school for her gymnastics competition. My boss is up my ass about this. My wife wants to go do this with me. Yeah, like I have the time to sit down and look up all these definitions. So I'm just going to vote yes, or I'm just going to vote no. But as you said, Lorianne, they don't even know what it means before they press the button in the voting booth. It's crazy. And they justify that they don't have the time. Now, I get that we're all very busy. But my thought is for the people, and I'm not blaming people who don't have the time. I totally get it. We're all busy. Some of us busier than others. But if you're not going to research it, don't go into the voting booth and press the button. I mean, you're just contributing to the problem.
Absolutely. You know, just because it's there doesn't mean you have to vote on it. You can skip it.
All right.
Yeah, really. If you don't really understand what it is, just leave it blank and move on to the next thing. Do everybody a favor. Did I lose you? I hope not.
No. I thought you were in the middle of a thought.
Oh, good. Okay. Oh, no. No, that was my thought.
Okay. Because, you mentioned...
Because I just don't think people even have that option. They don't even think about, like, not voting, like leaving a box blank. They don't even think about that. It's like they get that choice in front of them, and that's the only choice they have. They have to vote for this thing. They must. Otherwise, they're not a patriotic American because they didn't vote on something. They didn't check a box. Yeah. Where was I? Where were you?
Well, I was thinking since each of us has used the term employee as an example of redefining words we think we know the meaning of, I thought it might be fun to provide your audience with the definition of employee for the purpose of payroll withholding. Okay, we all know that withholding is to be done from the employee. So the question then becomes, who is the employee? And I'm going to guess 99 out of 100 of the people who are listening to us right now, I know what it is. It's anybody who works for the boss, right? So that's not what it means in the law pertaining to payroll withholding. And you can look this up yourself. You can find it at 26 USC 3401C. This is the definition of employee. Now, before I say it, for those of you who are unfamiliar with this particular issue or how Congress or legislatures redefine terms, if you work for somebody else right now, I want you to listen to this definition carefully. And I want you to see if there's anything in this definition that no matter how you twist, bend, or mangle this definition, how you could possibly make it be you. Okay? That's the challenge here. Can you make what's written here as the definition, can you make it be you? Can you convince yourself it's you? All right. With that as this background, here's the definition of employee for the purpose of payroll withholding. Go ahead.
Nope, you go ahead. Challenge accepted.
Okay.
Let's put it in that context. Okay. We have a challenge before us to actually hear the definition of what employee is, according to the law, and ask ourselves, does it really apply to me?
Employee, quote, for the purposes of this chapter, the term employee includes an officer, employee, or elected official of the United States, a state, or any political subdivision thereof, or the District of Columbia, or any agency or instrumentality of any one or more of the foregoing. Huh. If I asked somebody, if I read this definition to somebody, if I was in a personal conversation, I read this definition, who would they say is being described? I want to read it again, and I want your listeners to think, who is this describing? For the purpose of this chapter, the term employee includes an officer, employee, or elected official of the United States, a state, or any political subdivision thereof, or the District of Columbia, or any agency or instrumentality of any one or more of the foregoing. I think anybody who listens to that and they try and say, who is it who's being described there? They would say, these are people who work for various government agencies. It's not me in the private sector. Now, I want to close what some people may consider in their minds a potential loophole, and that is this. The definition says, for the purpose of this chapter, the term employee includes, now I've had people over the years say, includes indicates there may be other people. And those folks are not wrong. They just misunderstand and mean includes just blasts the doors off. You can add anything you want because it says includes, including people who work in the private sector, even though there's nothing about private sector in the definition. Because it uses the word include, some people will say, oh, you just throw that in there. You just include it. As if tax law means whatever people come up with in their head, right? So let me share with you the definition of includes. Now, I'm not going to read you the very lengthy 1913 definition because it's kind of a brain twister, but I'm going to tell you what, by the way, you can go look it up for yourself if you want. It's at 26 USC 7701A30. So you can look it up for yourself. But I'm going to give you the plain English version of it. And includes means this. If you take the items that appear after the word includes, you and find the narrowest category that reasonably applies to those terms, anything in that category can be added to the definition, even if not enumerated in the definition. So let me give you an example. In this hypothetical example, let's say Congress was enacting a law that in one of the words they used in the law was food. Okay? So in their statute, they write, food includes peaches, pears, kumquats, bananas. Okay? So what do the items after includes, what is the smallest reasonable category you can infer? That would be fruit, yes? Because the enumerated items form a category, reasonably form a category that's fruit, even though they're not enumerated, you can also add peaches and apples and strawberries and blueberries. If you went into court and said this food tax doesn't apply because I'm dealing with blueberries and they're not enumerated, the court would rule against you because blueberries do fit within the category and therefore they may be included even though they're not enumerated. So that's what includes means. So going back to employee, obviously everything after the word includes is some form of government worker. So if there's let's say the EPA is an example. The United States Supreme Court has ruled the EPA is an extra constitutional organization. In other words, it's created outside of and beyond the Constitution, which is something we're not going to get into tonight, but it's a very fascinating subject, how that
could be possible,
right?
You're already giving me ideas for show number five. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, so the EPA is obviously not enumerated in that statute, but because it's funded by Congress and it's within the exclusive legislative jurisdiction of Congress, it can be included, it can be considered as part of the definition, even though it is not there by enumeration. I also want to point out that the word state, as used in this definition of employee, does not mean a state of the union. Again, this is how people get confused when they don't read the definitions. The definition of state, when dealing geographically, means the possessions and territories under the exclusive legislative jurisdiction of Congress. It does not mean states of the union. So a state can be DC, a state can be Puerto Rico, a state can be Guam, but as used in this definition, state is not New Jersey, Oregon, California, Texas, Alabama, none of those. Because that's not what state means in this particular area of law. And by the way, Congress knows exactly what they're doing because throughout the vast majority of U.S. income tax law, state means places that are under the exclusive legislative jurisdiction of Congress, which is not the states of the union. However, when Congress wants to include the states of the union, it knows how to do so. So, for instance, in the statute that makes it a crime for an IRS employee to divulge confidential tax information without consent of their superiors, in that statute, state is defined to include the 50 states. So they know exactly how to write it when they want to include the 50 states. And the vast majority of the time, the word state does not include the 50 states. It means federal states, not states of the union. And I know for people who, this may be a case of first impressions, they've never heard this before, they might be thinking, oh, this is too much. Absolutely too much. I don't buy it. This is nonsense. It can't be that way. It can't be that contrived. It can't be that screwed up. Sorry, it is, and it's been this way. Yeah, and it's been this way actively for at least 100 years. These gimmicks were not terribly prevalent before the turn of the 20th century. But since roughly 1910-ish, these gimmicks just exploded in federal law, and they are now the rule, not the exception.
Sad but true. You know, and I think that anybody that has half a brain that watches how our government works should be able to go, yeah, they deliberately set this up this way. They deliberately are being deceitful toward the American people to deliberately make them not understand these nuances, to fool people into thinking what it, you know, that it, that a term or phrase like state means what it, you know, means what it, when you say state, in my mind, I think of the 50 states, you know.
Yes.
That's just automatically what happens.
May I give you another example, someone that's featured prominently throughout the tax code, and people absolutely believe they know what it means, and they have no clue. And it's much more broad-based than employee for the purpose of payroll withholding. That's a very specific definition for a very specific area within the tax code. The one I'm about to share is much more widespread throughout the tax code, and it is the phrase trade and business, trade or business. So a person is reading along and they say, this and such is required if you're involved in a trade or business. Okay, so the average good-hearted American who thinks the law means what it says, they say, oh, well, just kind of like U.S. person, I'm involved in trade or business, that's me. So if I'm going to be compliant with the law, I have to do whatever it says here. Otherwise, the government's going to come screw with me, right? So the definition of trade or business in the tax code, now, again, all of these things have little tiny exceptions. So as an example, once I give you the meaning of trade or business, in probably 99% of the time, 99 instances of seeing trade or business, it's going to mean what I tell you. There might be that one time where they've redefined it for just the use in that section or that paragraph or that subparagraph. So definitions are a tricky business, but this is pervasively the meaning of trade or business in tax law. And it means the performance of a public office. So people read trade or business, who the hell would think that means somebody who works for, I don't know, the State Department, carrying out their job as tasked by the Secretary of State? Who would think the trade or business means the performance of a public office? But that's exactly how it's defined for the purposes of the tax code. Right. But I wanted to share that one because it's far more pervasive and one might say less forgivable than employee. I think employee is pretty egregious, but trader business is just beyond. I mean, it almost makes me want to think of doing violent things to the people in government when they find it acceptable to fake out, to make fools of the American people so that they can continue committing the largest financial crime in history.
Depending on it. And I don't even think that our Congress members, our legislators even know. Because they've lived their whole lives under the same brainwashing. So I think a lot of them don't really even know these nuances either. And they're still operating. They're committing this fraud kind of knowingly and unknowingly at the same time.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And all somebody has to do in order to grasp that. I don't think there's very many Americans that think that their legislators are brilliant. Okay? Normally, it's the left-right paradigm, right? Somebody on the right looks at a politician and says, you know, he says stuff I like, so I'm voting for him. And people on the left, you know, they look at their politicians who are running for office and they say, well, I really like the positions that she holds. I'm absolutely going to vote for her in the election. But none of them would tell you, oh, yes, the person I'm voting for, they must have an IQ of 200. They're brilliant. No, nobody ever thinks that, right? So if somebody wants to amuse themselves, here's something like, I'm just going to give you one example because it shows the mind numbingness. Okay, so if you're listening to the show and you're taking notes, write this down, 26 CFR 1.861. Okay, now, it's actually 861 et sequitur. Now, et sequitur in law means and what follows. So when I say 861, I mean read all of the information in that subpart, okay, which is, I don't know, 123 pages, something like that, of eight-point type. And you read through it, yeah. Oh, it's brutal. I've read the whole thing a couple of times out of necessity because I was writing about it or speaking about it. But here's my point. If your listeners go do that, if they do go 26 CFR 1.861 et sequitur and they start reading, they can even go a couple pages in and just start reading anywhere. It doesn't matter. Within less than 5 minutes, they're going to say, the congressman who represents me or the senator who represents my state, they have no idea what any of this means because it's just incredibly detailed and nuanced and unusual and topics that nobody knows anything about. So to imagine that, Ron Paul, who's a medical doctor, to imagine that he knows anything that knows what 861 or anything beyond that means is absurd. What's her, AOC? To imagine that she's got a bachelor's in economics. To imagine that she knows anything, the meaning of anything in 861, people would literally, on both sides of the aisle, laugh themselves out of the chair thinking that their politician actually understands any of that. And my point is that you are correct, Lorianne. Our elected officials have zero knowledge of the scam that's going on in the tax code. Maybe the couple of people who've been around forever, like Mitch McConnell. Who's that shrew from California on the Democrat side? Nancy Pelosi. These couple of fossils at the very top of the food chain and the career employees, not the politician appointed people, but the top career employees at the Treasury Department and the IRS, they know the truth. But likely the people in government who know the truth probably don't exceed, even if we add those that have been retired from those positions and are still alive, probably doesn't exceed, I don't know, 250 people in the whole nation. Tens of thousands of people have read Income Tax Shadow in the Mist. So my point being there, that there are exponentially more ordinary run-of-the-mill Americans who understand the income tax scam than there are people in the employ of the government who understand the income tax scam.
think that, you know, I can't help but think that we see, like, with the job numbers, for example, you know, that they're reporting, which, of course, are fudged. I mean, they've been correcting them month after month after month. They boast all these great, you know, job numbers, and then, you know, those hit the headlines. And then a couple months later, they're like, oh, yeah, that was bloated. We had to revise those down. And, of course, those don't get a lot of fanfare, right? But these people, they're that are creating jobs mostly in the government sector. And I can't help but think, I wonder why that is. Because maybe, just maybe, there's people like you that are spreading the actual truth about the income tax and who it applies to and what an employee is. And so thereby, if we bloat the government and more and more and more of a percentage of people are actually employed by a state or federal government agency, all that, then they can get by with actually applying, quote-unquote, legitimately applying the taxes, income taxes on them, because they're a state or federal person working for the government. So bloat the government more and more and more. And then once more and more people actually start to realize the truth about it, then that's the next level. It's like, but yeah, you know what? It actually does apply to you, because that's how employee is defined and you work for the government. See what I mean? Like, how that's like another level of the scam?
It's exactly that, although I would say it's another layer of the scam. And what I mean by that is that when we discussed the term employee for purpose of payroll withholding, we just talked about that single definition. We didn't get into the broader issues of upon whom the payroll withholding is to take place. But law, I've often said, the rule of real estate is location, location, location. The rule of law is context, context, context. So payroll withholding sits, it is a mechanism whereby tax is withheld. So that mechanism sits within the broader scope of the income tax itself. It's not independent of the income tax. It is a tool for collecting the income tax. And as we discussed earlier, the income tax has been imposed on non-resident aliens with U.S. source income, foreign corporations with U.S. source income, U.S. citizens residing abroad with foreign earned income, and that fourth class has been made liable as U.S. persons who actually have withheld U.S. income tax before they sent the money offshore to its foreign owners. Nowhere in those three classes and the fourth one made liable, nowhere did you hear working for the government, because that's not upon whom the withholding mechanism applies. And let me explain why. If you work for Walmart, they can't withhold from you. Now, I know people are going to be screaming at their computers right now. You know, well, it does. They take the money. Yes, I understand that America has rectal cranial inversion about the law and have no idea what it means, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So, yes, if Walmart is withholding and they're violating the law and their workers don't know anything about it and the workers don't care and the workers are in the matrix and they believe it's okay. So, but here's the thing, those workers at Walmart don't owe the income tax because they're not within any of the three classes, yes? All right, so if somebody gets a job working for, I live in Nevada, so we'll say working for the Nevada DMV, did they suddenly lose their right of property? Did they suddenly fall within one of the three classes simply because they work for the DMV? No, not at all. And remember, payroll withholding is merely a mechanism to collect the tax. But the tax has to be collected from someone upon whom it has been imposed. Non-resident aliens with U.S. source income. So what the withholding statutes are, is it is instructions from Congress to government agencies under the exclusive legislative jurisdiction of Congress, that when they cut payroll to a non-resident alien, it is mandatory that they use the withholding mechanism specified at 3402 that we've been referring to repeatedly. Now, follow me on this. The reason that's limited to the government is, well, let's say, I don't know, Bureau of Prisons. Okay. When the Bureau of Prisons cuts a check to a worker that's a non-resident alien, does the Bureau of Prison know absolutely, definitively, without doubt, that the income being paid out is from a U.S. source? Yeah, because they are the source. So there's no question it's coming from a U.S. source. So when there is no question of that it's a U.S. source, Congress has told its own agencies and instrumentalities, there's no question it's a U.S. source. So if you're paying it to a non-resident alien, it is mandatory that you use the mechanism specified at 3402 in order to withhold the U.S. income tax before you give the money to the non-resident alien. So I share all of that. I hope I expressed it clearly, but I share all of that to make the point that even if somebody an ordinary American citizen goes to work for a state or the federal government, it doesn't change the fact that they're not a person upon whom the tax has been imposed, and therefore the collection mechanism cannot be employed against them.
Therein lies another part of the scam.
Right.
No, you phrased that really well. You phrased that very well.
Thank you.
I'm going to kind of switch gears a little bit, you know, because I've often been asked, you know, well, what about state income taxes? You know, because we're assuming here that, you know, we're only talking about federal income tax. But what about state income tax? You know, because the states impose an income tax too, right?
Some do.
On top of it, you know, yeah, most of them do. But yet therein lies the other nuance. Is the states that impose a state income tax, you describe that very well, too. I don't want to put words in your mouth or phrase it, but I want for the listeners out there to understand how the two things are tied together. Would you briefly kind of describe how the state income tax ties in with the federal income tax?
You bet. I'm happy to do that. So state income tax is upon the exact same class of person or classes of persons, and it is for the exact same activity, receiving U.S. source income. So let's say that a person is a non-resident alien from, I don't know, we'll say France, okay? Under U.S. income tax law, he qualifies as a non-resident alien. But he's in this country temporarily, and he's working a job for, I don't know, a computer company, software company. So the tax, because he's a non-resident alien, he's within a class. And in terms of the fact that he's a foreign person, the source of the income is obviously from within the U.S., okay? So it's the same tax of people. Okay? It's simply another additional jurisdiction taking its cut. Here's an example I like to use. Let's say you're driving down the road. It's a 50-mile-an-hour speed limit, and you get pulled over. You're doing 80. And you happen to be within a city that's within a county. So the way the law works there, although there's just one offense, there's just one person who committed the offense, the county gets some of the fine, and the city gets some of the fine. It's still the same guy in the same car with the same vehicle code violating the same statute, but multiple jurisdictions share in the money they took from the citizen. Okay? So it's the same exact thing with the income tax. As a matter of fact, the IRS and state tax agencies work together hand in glove. Now, they exchange information. Sometimes the IRS will literally say, we believe Joe Citizen owes us some tax, but we're busy going after him for these 4 years. So we're going to reach out to California, to the Franchise Tax Board, and we're going to say, we want you to go after him for these other years. Well, clearly they both couldn't go after the poor guy if it wasn't the same tax upon the same person. If it was a different tax, a separate tax, a tax that wasn't identical, then they couldn't work together like that. Here's the thing. Any state that enacts an income tax, if they want the support of the federal government, if they want to work with the IRS and with the Treasury Department on enforcement of the income tax, they have to submit before they pass it, before it even hits the legislature's floor for a vote, they have to submit their proposed statutes to the United States Department of Treasury. Excuse me, the United States Department of Treasury then has to approve the state's income tax laws. When you read state income tax laws, for instance, one of the big definitions in the tax code, let me rephrase, one of the big definitions to people who don't study tax law, it's kind of meaningless to people like me, but for the public, people who are uninformed, one of the definitions that's cited frequently by accountants and people for the government stuff is Section 61, the definition of gross income. So when you read through the income tax laws of a state that has income tax, it will tell you the term gross income has the same meaning as in Section 61 of the Internal Revenue Code. When you see the next one, it says the definition of adjusted gross income. It's going to tell you has the same meaning as the definition in the Internal Revenue Code in Section 62. When you get to taxable income, it's going to tell you taxable income in the state of whatever has the same meaning as Section 63 in the Internal Revenue Code. Everything is the same. Everything. It's the same tax upon the same people in the same set of circumstances for the same activity. It's just two separate jurisdictions, each getting their taste of that person's, of what that person owes in income tax.
You know, it's almost like you're describing our government, state and federal, as a bunch of, like, mafia crime bosses all working together. You know, you control this area over here. Yeah, we'll control that over here.
Right. And that's because there's money on the table. Like I said, the largest financial crime in history. And, you know, it's funny because people have oftentimes asked me why the government doesn't, I don't know, for lack of a better term, give me a hard time. And I point out that to do so would only hurt the government because now the government's got it made, right? So I'm going to just use a hypothetical figure here. Probably 96% of the American public believes the government's false narrative about income tax, that it applies to everybody. If you earn a living, you have to give a percentage to the government. That's what the law says. They actually believe that falsehood, right? So that 96%, the government owns them because of the people's own unwillingness to actually, in this case, I'll say, read a single book and discover the truth. Because they're unwilling to read a book, the government owns them, lock, stock, and barrel. They're all, those people are always going to give the government their money. And right now, the government's got it good. I don't know how many people I'm able to reach between my book and marketing and appearing on podcasts. And readers of Income Tax Shouting Us, promoting it to others. I don't know how many people are reached. But I think it would probably be a safe guess that it doesn't add up to 0.1% of the U.S. population. The government were to go to war with me because I'm telling the truth, that would become news. That would draw attention to the truth. That would draw attention to income tax shattering the myths. That would draw attention to the controversy. That would mean mainstream media, people like CNN and Fox News, might actually want to sit down with me and talk about the income tax. Because the government made income tax shattering the myths. The government made Dave Champion an issue. Right now, the government's got it made. It doesn't need to fight me. It doesn't need to fight anybody else who's out there promoting the truth, because the government is winning lock, stock, and barrel, because the American people believe the government. They want to believe the government, as far as I can tell. They think that makes them, I don't want to say they think, that makes them feel safe and secure and comfortable to believe the government. And I talk to people who generally distrust the government, but then they'll say, oh, when it comes to the income tax, well, the government wouldn't lie about that. And the government is working quietly behind the scenes to make sure that no one who has the public's ears is talking about income tax. I'll tell you a story. About a year ago, a person who I've been acquainted with for some time reached out to me and said, I want to tell you what was just shared with me by one of my close friends. So this was his close friend sharing it with him, and then he called me. Okay? So his close All friend, right. they've known each other since they were kids. His close friend had been building a podcast audience for years, and the audience became large enough that one of these major podcast platforms, I don't have all the details because the gentleman who called me said, if I divulge all of that, I'm breaching confidentiality with my longtime friend. But he wanted me to know the outlines. So he said that his friend was offered a paying gig on one of these large platforms, sort of like the Joe Rogan with Spotify, right? That kind of, not quite that kind of money, but you get the point. He was going to be making a nice living from sitting behind a microphone and doing what he'd been doing for some time and building that audience. Now, finally, he was going to get compensated well for that by a large platform. So he agreed. They talked about the money and everything was agreed to. So they said, okay, well, now we have to send you over the contract and go ahead and get it signed and get it back to us, and you'll be getting paid bank to be a podcaster on our platform. So unlike most people, this gentleman actually read through the contract. And in the contract, there were certain topics that he agreed never to discuss while he was podcasting on that network. One of them was to talk about whether or not the income tax applies to ordinary working Americans.
You
can imagine that podcast platform didn't come up with that provision on their own. Somebody at the Treasury Department reached out to their attorney and said, if you don't want any trouble from the IRS, you're going to put this in your agreement. Because if we start hearing your podcasters talking about the income tax in this way, this aspect of the income tax, oh, you guys are going to get an IRS proctological exam like you've never had before. And I guarantee you, you're going to owe a lot more in income tax when we're done with you. So go ahead and don't put that in there if you want us to fuck you. And you can imagine the podcast management, right? They've got shareholders to satisfy. They were like, no, 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 no. We don't want any problems from you. So we'll put that provision in our contract for our podcasters. And it's interesting because as podcasting has become more of a real thing in society, I think at one time it was an outlier. Now it's prevalent. Everybody loves podcasts. Everybody's listening to them. The number of podcasters who will actually have me on and talk about the income tax is infinitesimally small. I was set up to talk about it with one. There was co-hosts, a gentleman and a woman. This woman is a libertarian, which should catch in your craw. And the gentleman was like, "Yeah, I'll have you on." So when he reached out to his co-host and said, hey, we're going to have Dave Champion on, the libertarian half said, absolutely not. We've got a good thing going right now. If you have him on to talk about the income tax, we're going to get fucked. We're not going to do that. We're not going to have him on. And the male half buckled and said, I'm sorry, we can't have you on.
Wow. Wow. So, yeah, it's like even libertarians are too scared.
Oh, my God. Libertarians are the worst, Lorianne.
Thinking of my boots.
They're the libertarians are the absolute worst on this subject. They're worse than Republicans. They're worse than Democrats. They absolutely will not talk about it. I've reached out to either directly or through intermediaries who I know have personal relationships with these libertarian leaders, names that everybody who's libertarian would immediately recognize. And I've either contacted them directly or through their through intermediaries who know them well, or in one case I reached out through a gal who is the PR person. And these people who are notable names, they are at the top of the food pyramid of the Libertarian Party, or we'll say people, they're at the top of the food chain for people who fancy themselves libertarian. These people will not discuss the truth of the income tax. There is an absolute libertarian blackout on the truth of the income tax.
That really surprises me because, I mean, libertarians tend to be the ones, you know, and the Fed, you know. Libertarians are the ones, like, you know, the IRS is unconstitutional. It shouldn't even be there. It needs to get the axe. But the libertarians are the ones that want to, you know, give the chopping block to all of these unconstitutional government agencies, and then including the income tax. They're very vocal on the topic. So it boggles my mind why they would be so afraid to have you on as a guest like I am here. I'm not afraid. I'm having you on for the fourth time talking about this stuff. I want to talk about it. Surprises me.
What's the most common slogan concerning taxation in libertarian circles? Taxation is theft.
Yep.
Right. Now, a couple of these libertarian leaders that I reached out to, I had one-on-one discussions with them. And I said, in terms of holding any offices of significance, in other words, anything beyond like maybe a seat on a town council or, you know, a county dog catcher, aside from that, the Libertarian Party is failing miserably. They're not getting, I mean, how many people in Congress right now are libertarians? Arguably two, okay? And that's including those who may be running as Republicans may run for election as Republicans or Democrats, but they're libertarian-minded. Okay, we're talking two, maybe three out of 535 elected officials on the Hill. Okay, so the Libertarian Party, in my estimation, is failing miserably, completely a failure. So I said to a couple of these notable names, these leaders, I said, one of the reasons that the Libertarian Party is failing so miserably is you don't have any issues. You're not changing anything. You're just running your mouths. You're espousing principles, but you have no power to change anything because all you do is talk. And you don't, and oh my God, libertarians argue amongst themselves more than Democrats and Republicans argue against one another, right?
Oh, that I know.
Yes, I know. Libertarians.
You're not libertarian
enough. So many libertarians despise other libertarians. The party and the very philosophy when you bring it into the political sphere is a complete and utter failure. So I talked to some of these libertarian leaders, and I said, you know, the magic of the income tax from a libertarian perspective is you're not advocating that anybody commit civil disobedience. You're not telling them, you know, shut down the government. you're not telling them to, you know, handcuff themselves to each other and form a human chain across the doors of some institution that you despise. You're not doing that. The truth of the income tax, what you're doing is telling the libertarian constituency, I want you to get educated. And once you get educated, we can starve the federal government and state governments. We can starve them of the resources they need for their grotesque overreach. We can stop them from getting involved in every single aspect of our lives. And we can stop them from doing that by obeying the law. You stop paying when you understand what the law says, and you say, I'm now going to obey the law. I know who the income tax applies to. It's not me, so I'm not going to file, and I'm not going to pay anymore. I said, so really what you can do is you guys can start a movement where by obedience to the law, not civil disobedience, but actual obedience to the law, you can deprive this grotesque monster called government of its fuel source. The constant
exactly right. I've kind of said similar
trillions
things.
Of dollars.
If you really want to pull on the, if you really want to limit government and shrink the size of government, you got to attack them at the purse strings. And by attacking them at the purse strings means you got to understand that the income tax scam that is upon them, the vast majority of Americans, is the way to go. That is like the freeway that libertarians could use to get that message across. And I love what you're saying, that it's by complying with the law as it's stated that by which we can do that.
Yeah, I also want to take a step further. First of all, they always say, wow, that's a really interesting perspective. And that's the end of the conversation. I never hear from them again. Also, anyone who's a notable name in the libertarian sphere, I have always sent, all they have to do is agree to read it. I send them complimentary copies of Income Tax Shattering the Myths. Okay. Any notable libertarian leadership name you can think of, I have sent them a complimentary copy of Income Tax Shattering the Myths. To my knowledge, at this time, after years of doing this, exactly zero libertarian leaders have read Income Tax Shattering the Myths. That's how uninterested they are in this crucial matter of liberty, in this crucial matter of putting the government in its place. They have zero interest. They're not, they don't really believe what they're saying to the libertarian community. And I find that egregious and obnoxious. They're as bad or worse than the Democrats and Republicans, and it pains me to say that.
Yeah, I mean, because we all know that the Democrats and Republicans, I mean, you know, they're on the top of the list as far as getting us where we're at, you know, and the levels of corruption, RNC, DNC, blah, blah, blah. And I would, you know, even me, being a very, you know, libertarian person, I'm a registered libertarian, you know, I would want the Libertarian Party to be a mechanism by which to dismantle all of that corruption, you know, and influence the dismantling of that corruption of the two-party system and the monopoly that it has over us. And yet it's at the same time exactly what you're saying. It's like the libertarians seem to have like this dick measuring contest with each other all the time, bickering amongst each other, and yet not willing to actually take up the issues that truly do matter. And it's a Republican in Ohio that last year and is, you know, trying to revive it to abolish the 16th Amendment. And it's like, that's something a libertarian should be doing.
and that Republican should read
Resolution 47, I believe it is. Ohio congressman introduces a bill to repeal the 16th Amendment, arguing the government shouldn't tax income. It's Congressman Warren Davidson, a Republican in Ohio. And, of course, you know, the Congress has just let it sit there. They haven't voted on it. They haven't moved it forward. And now, you know, he's like, hey, you know, this is just sitting there. We need to move this forward. Every single libertarian-minded person should be behind this guy and should be writing our congresspeople going, hey, you know, this is a legitimate thing. You know, you shouldn't just set this aside and ignore it.
So one of the things that people will learn when they read Income Tax Shattering the Myths is the 16th Amendment did not do what the average uninformed American believes it did. If you write the IRS and say, what's your authority to impose an income tax, they will tell you it's the 16th Amendment. And as we can expect, that's a lie. I remember when I guess my daughter was about 11th grade, and I asked, she was reading history one night for homework, and I asked to see her book, and I went through it until I found the part about income tax, about the 16th Amendment specifically, because it was like a timeline of history in her book. And I went through the timeline until I found the 16th Amendment. And it said that the 16th Amendment authorized Congress to impose an income tax on the American people. So none of that's true, by the way. Congress has had the authority to impose an income tax upon the American people since the founding of this nation. The purpose of the 16th Amendment was to correct an incorrect decision made by the Supreme Court in 1895 in a case called Pollack. And in Pollack, I'm not going to get into it, it's fairly nuanced, and people who haven't read Income Tax Shattering the Myths will get lost in about 30 seconds, but dealt with direct and indirect taxes and how those kind of taxes should be addressed by federal tax law. And the court got it wrong in Pollack. So the elites, the power elites, put forth the 16th Amendment to correct Pollack, which was merely just an interpretation of one particular kind of transaction between direct and indirect tax. It had nothing to do with whether the federal government could impose an income tax. That had nothing to do with the 16th Amendment. In the Bushaver case in 1916, when the court was reviewing the 16th Amendment and passing judgment on it, the court said that the 16th Amendment granted Congress no new taxing powers. In other words, if it was taxable before the 16th Amendment, afterwards it remained taxable. If it was not taxable before the 16th Amendment, it remained non-taxable after the 16th Amendment. All the 16th Amendment did was correct an incorrect earlier decision that dealt with a nuance of tax law. So the last thing leadership on the Hill wants to do with Davidson's bill is to get the public involved in a conversation about the 16th Amendment, because first of all, Davidson doesn't know what it means, or he wouldn't even be putting that bill forth. If Davidson and I sat down on the phone and talked about this, I would explain to him that in terms of the current modern U.S. income tax that was enacted in 1913 and is still active in its core form today, that the 16th Amendment is totally irrelevant, and I would hope he would withdraw his bill. Now, the only thing that the only good I can see coming from a bill like that passing, which is never going to happen, the only good thing I can see about it is once the 16th Amendment in this mythical scenario, once the 16th Amendment was abolished, the income tax would continue. So people would then understand the 16th Amendment did not authorize the income tax.
Very good point.
The only problem with abolishing the 16th Amendment is then the incorrect determination of the court of Pollack would revert to being the law. And I don't think anybody, people who oppose the income tax, people who support the income tax, nobody would want to go back to an incorrect interpretation of law. Well, I shouldn't say that. An incorrect interpretation of the Constitution. Nobody wants to go back. And that's what Pollack was, an incorrect interpretation of the Constitution. So on the upside, people would realize, wow, the 16th Amendment's gone and the government is still, you know, promoting and administrating and enforcing an income tax. That didn't change when the 16th Amendment went away, but certain aspects of tax law would then be subject to the incorrect decision of Pollock. So it's a mixed bag. But the good news is, that, you know, if you're not a non-resident alien with U.S. source income, you're not a foreign corporation with U.S. source income, you're not a U.S. citizen residing abroad with foreign income, and you're not a U.S. person serving as a withholding agent of U.S. income tax on U.S. source income belonging to a foreign person, if none of those things are true, who gives a shit about the 16th Amendment?
Yeah, well, exactly. A good point. And then maybe that's another part of this thing, because, you know, if I'm reading this HJ Resolution 47, Joint Resolution, proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the United States to repeal the 16th Article of the Amendment, resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America and Congress, assembled two-thirds of each house and concurring therein, Section 1, that the following article is proposed as an amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which shall be valid to all its intents and purposes as part of the Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states within 7 years. So it wouldn't even take effect until 7 years after the date of its submission for ratification. The article says, effective 2 years after the ratification of this article of amendment, the 16th article of amendment to the Constitution of the United States is repealed, and the Congress shall have no power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, except in time of war declared by the Congress. Therein lies the thing. That phrase right there automatically makes me, well, boy, isn't that giving an incentive for our government to constantly be declaring wars, actually declaring wars all over the freaking world so that we could perpetually always be in a time of war by which Congress could impose and collect taxes on our income?
Yeah. And right? By the way, if Davidson knew what he was talking about, all that bill would have to say would be that he's proposing an amendment that would prohibit the federal government from taxing incomes except in time of war. That whole thing about the 16th Amendment is irrelevant to doing that, because it's the second half where he talks about prohibiting the government from taxing income. That part would nullify the federal government's ability to impose an income tax. But, you know, here's the thing when we look at that, and people are probably, a lot of people are cheering that, oh, my God, the government wouldn't be able to impose an income tax. Oh, that's so wonderful. Okay, so the income tax really applies to the three classes that we've discussed again and again tonight. So I'm not sure why people are thrilled that we can't tax foreigners with U.S. source income, why we can't tax foreign corporations with U.S. source income. And the third class, it's such a trivial amount of people, it's irrelevant when I say U.S. citizens residing abroad with foreign income. So let's exclude that for the purpose of this. If people know the truth about the income tax, that it only applies to for the sake of this part of our discussion, the first two classes, why are people excited that we're not going to tax those people anymore? I mean, those are the people that, if we're going to tax people, we're going to tax foreigners who are benefiting from investing their money in our country. I don't have an objection to that. And because I know what the law says and I haven't filed or paid in 30 years, I have zero objection to the income tax. My objection is to the government bullshitting the American people. My objection is the American people being so dense, so lazy, so brainwashed, they won't read a single book to figure out the truth. That's my beef. I have no beef with the income tax as properly applied. I don't know why any American would.
Also a very good point. Very good point. Exactly. I mean, isn't that what should, you know, because this is foreign stuff, you know, foreign derived income.
Right.
You know, right? So maybe there should be a tax on that, not on American citizens. Exactly. And then even in your book, too, you even break down, because I've had people even ask me, like, you know, what about the fair tax? What about the flat tax? All these flat tax advocates and fair tax advocates. And you get into your book about what that really means, too. The fair tax.
Yes.
Isn't really so fair. The flat tax. Oh, it sounds simple enough, but you know, maybe not so
and
much.
Both
I guess before we get into other topics, and I know I want to get a Q&A involved, but briefly try to give listeners your take on the so-called fair tax and flat tax.
Well, you know, one is basically a national sales tax. And the other is just an income tax that purports to tax everybody equally. Okay? So the federal government has no constitutional authority to impose a sales tax. That's utter nonsense. The states have something in law called general jurisdiction. They can pass laws on pretty much anything they want, as long as they're not substantially imposing upon the exercise of the rights of the people. They can create laws for just about anything they want. Congress, on the other hand, the United States government is a government of limited, enumerated powers. They do not have general jurisdiction. They have limited jurisdiction. And that does not extend to creating a national sales tax. So people who are rooting for that, it's just more of what I've mentioned a few times. They don't do any research. They don't know anything. It's just they go, that sounds nifty. I'd like to see that. Okay, that's great. It sounds nifty, perhaps, but Congress will never do it because they can't, and they know that. At least the people at the top of the food chain know that. And then, you know, taxing everybody equally. What a pipe dream. Do you know how long it would take before the deductions and exemptions and so forth would start being built into the law? Because you can't pass a law. Let's say it says that Dave Champion is going to get taxed $200 a year, and Lorianne is going to get taxed $200 a year, and Bill Gates is going to get taxed $200 a year, whatever the number is. It doesn't matter what our revenue is. It doesn't matter what, you know, how we're invested. It doesn't matter how the amount of money we bring in the door. None of that matters, because under this proposal, everyone's going to pay the same amount. That's never going to happen. The first thing that's going to happen, we're never going to get this far. But if it were to be proposed or were to become law, the very first conversation to take place is, it's fine if Dave Champion and Lori Ann and Bill Gates pay whatever we'll call it, $8,000 a year. It's fine if they pay $8,000 a year, but you can't expect the homeless man to pay $8,000 a year. So now we need exemptions for the homeless man. But the whole thing would collapse. It's just sheer stupidity. And it would also be unconstitutional for the same reasons that the income tax, if applied to you and I, would be unconstitutional, because the federal government doesn't have that authority. I might add, if Congress had the authority to tax our labor, the way I like to refer to it is, you know, the ordinary American gets up in the morning, they have a little breakfast, they cup of coffee, they get the kids off to school, they go to work, they do whatever they do to earn a living, and they get a paycheck. If Congress had the authority to tax that person in that scenario, the income tax would not be limited to the three classes we've discussed. If Congress could tax the labor of the American people, it would have long ago. So when people talk about a tax, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be equal across the board. You're still taxing the property, the earnings of the American people. And Congress has no authority to do that. If they did, it would have been done long ago. So, again, people don't know anything about the Constitution. They don't know anything about the limited authority of Congress. They don't know anything about taxation. But they say to themselves, well, that's a nifty idea, and suddenly they're on board with nonsense. I mean, by the way, if anybody supports either of those two taxes, I'm not saying you're stupid. What I'm saying is I hope you'll go out and get informed. I hope you'll read Income Tax Shattering the Myths, because I discuss all three forms of taxation, the income tax as it exists now, and the idea that we're going to tax everybody equally, and the idea of a national sales tax. I discuss all of that, and I lay it out, and I lay out the constitutional principles and the limits that are imposed in the Constitution, what the Supreme Court has said about those limits and so forth. So I would encourage people to get informed before they jump on a bandwagon, one or another of the bandwagons that's out there.
Absolutely. And with that, I am going to, like, time flies. Like, it's like a time warp with you every time, and we always start getting short on time. So there is 13 and a half minutes left of the live broadcast. For those of you that are listening online, I know we got lots of people in the chat room right now, a lot of people that I'm familiar with in the chat room. Those of you that are out there listening, call in within the next 13 minutes, 563-999-3485, because that's when the live broadcast ends, and then we get into the bonus hour. But you have to be on the switchboard. You have to call in and be listening in order to continue on with us for that bonus hour. Otherwise, if you're listening online and you're not dialed in, you're going to lose your audio, and you'll have to listen to the show recording in order to listen to what we discuss in this next bonus hour. So again, 563-999-3485. And I do want to get to opening up the phone lines here soon as well for some Q&A with people that I know are probably anxious to ask you some questions. And but at the very beginning of the show and with talking with you before, you know, when I invited you on, I wanted to mention the video that you did on basically what the fuck are the voters thinking here in Oregon with Measure 110 and Measure 114 especially, because I know you're a big gun rights advocate, of course, you know, with your background, and yet we never seem to get to this topic, get to that topic. But I loved that video that you did. If you go to his Rumble channel, look up, I think you did it like a couple months ago or something. And so now as it stands, and talking about Measure 110, the decriminalization of drugs, the movement went forth to repeal that, and now it has been repealed.
Yep.
And I sent you like the rundown of it, so it's going to start imposing fines again. And there's, you know, it's pretty lenient when it comes to, you know, small amounts of certain drugs. The fines aren't all that exuberant, especially if it's, you know, first time and all that. And one of the things that I wanted to mention about this is that you even brought up in your video was that originally that measure changed how our legal marijuana tax revenues are distributed, and a good amount of those funds were supposed to go for opening up more and new drug and rehab facilities, which they weren't even required to do that according to in that legislation for a good deal of time, like almost 2 years. And so we have this influx of people overdosing on the streets, especially in Portland, but it's not exclusive to Portland. And we have this explosion of fentanyl going on. We have all of these problems as a result, and especially in overdose deaths. And the overdose deaths are really what fueled this effort to repeal what the voters passed. The voters passed it by, I think it was like 58%. And, you know, but therein lies the problem. You know, it's like they put the cart before the horse. You know, it was set up, I think, from the beginning to fail, because they didn't have the needed things in place to accommodate more people going in for, you know, drug and addiction treatment. So that's part of the problem. And, you know, most of them that got caught, you know, they'd rather pay that $100 because they don't want to give up their addictions. That's how people are. And I love in your video, you talk about how, you know, Well, people are fucked up. They're fucked up in various different ways. So I wanted you to speak to that a little bit, and then your thoughts on now that it has been effectively repealed by this legislation. What are your thoughts on that, real quick?
Where to begin? Because it's a complex subject, and I know we're short on time. I think the point that I wanted most people to take away when I did that presentation was when I said, "What the fuck are the voters thinking?" which is the title of the video. I want to know who the rocket scientists were behind this movement and the rocket scientists who went into the voting booth, who figured if you didn't attach criminal penalties to drug use, that suddenly drug addicts would make smarter, better decisions. Now, mind you, I have no dog in this fight, right? So I'm not taking sides. But the idea that because you say to drug addicts, well, we're not going to lock you in a cage anymore for the use of that drug, that they're going to, and we're going to make facilities and resources available to you if you want to get clean. So the idea that drug addicts are going to go, oh my God, oh, no more criminal penalties. Oh, and there's a place that I can go and get sober. Well, gosh, let me just make that decision now that you passed this law. That's not how drug addicts act. Drug addicts, you know, I don't know how many people have been involved with drugs. I was when I was a teenager. I was involved with drug addicts socially in that time of my life. I was involved with drug addicts when I was in law enforcement and so forth. You know, there's a statement that says nobody gets clean until they're ready. Okay? And, you know, some people are never ready, and some people die never being ready from the drugs. And what the hell a bunch of suit-wearing dweebs in the legislature pass into law is not in the least going to affect whether a drug addict chooses to get sober or not. The whole thing was childish bullshit from moment one. And it didn't help that they didn't fund any of the resources for 19 months after they decriminalized. But my belief is that it wouldn't have made any difference, because people who are drug addicts don't say, oh, look, the legislature opened up a little thing over there where I can go and get clean. So I'm going to go get clean because there it is. That's not how drug addicts think. So I thought the whole thing was nonsense. And the reason I said, what the fuck are these voters thinking about, is to me, it was such a childish notion. But I did support no longer putting drug addicts in cages, because that doesn't putting them in cages only does one thing. It keeps them alive longer. And in some cases, not a lot, since they may not be able to get drugs while they're in prison, they may, if they're in prison long enough without drugs, they may turn themselves around. But then what's the cost of that? You take somebody off the street and they're in prison for 4.5 years? And then when they come out, maybe they stay clean? This model has never made any sense to me. So to me, the whole thing front to back is ridiculous. I hope I expressed that clearly.
Absolutely, you did. Yeah, and you know, on top of that, it with this repeal, so like I said, originally, it took what the marijuana tax, legal marijuana tax, and changed the allocation so that more of that tax money went toward, it was supposed to go toward for more treatment facilities and all that jazz. Legislation that effectively, you know, recriminalizes drugs. Of course, it doesn't take that away either. So not only now are they getting more of a portion of the revenue from legal marijuana sales, now they're going to be getting another source of revenue by the fines that they impose on people that are caught with small amounts of these drugs. You know, they're not going to be thrown in jail for 4 years for a small amount, depending on what the drug is or whatever. But now, you know, they're going to be imposing these fines. So it's like double dipping. You know what I mean? It's they're going to get even more money out of the pockets of people that are doing drugs or that are caught doing drugs or with drug possession. Now they're going to get even more money there. And it's just yet another way to siphon more money so that our state, and I don't know if you know anything about Oregon and how it's run, but this is just one example of many of how inept the Oregon government is when it comes to actually spending the money it's supposed to on the things that it's supposed to. This is just another example of it. And so now they're going to be getting even more money that they can mismanage and waste and throw away. And so it's just absolutely ridiculous. And I agree with your position on it doesn't really address the core causes of this. It doesn't. It might maybe help prevent somebody from overdosing, maybe, but it's going to be so few and far between. I don't think it's going to really make that much of a difference at all when it comes to how many drug users there are, the kinds of drugs that are out there on the street, and how many people overdose from it. I really don't see that it's going to make that big a difference.
Yeah, I don't know if you're aware. I live in a small town, and consequently, and I get along with young people. So, you know, I probably know more young people than most people my age. And, you know, a lot of them, you know, a lot of drugs out here, a lot of them go down for drug charges and they get sent off to jail. And, you know, the funny thing is that, you know, they're addicts when they get busted and when they go away. And while they're there, they get counseling, and then they come out. And I've noticed a recurring cycle, and anybody I think who's familiar with young drug addicts and going to prison and coming back out and so forth, they're on probation or parole, depending. They have to do the testing, and they have to go to therapy and, you know, do counseling, not therapy, substance abuse counseling and so forth, right? And it's funny because they get out of jail, and I'll run into them around town. They're like, "Hey, Dave, ah, blah, blah, blah." And you know what? They're magnificent. They're clean. They're awesome. They're high on life. You know, they're going to the gym. They're pounding weights. They're feeling good. They got a job when they got out. Everything's going their way. Something triggers them because, remember, addictive personalities are addictive personalities, right? People don't get it. It's very, very rare for anybody to get addicted to drugs unless they have an addictive personality. These people have an addictive personality, which I believe is a psychological issue, right? It has to be dealt with. But it's usually not, because most of the drug and alcohol counseling is nonsense, right? So anyway, they get out of jail. They're high on life. They're having a great time. Everything's going their way. Something triggers that addiction side of their personality. And the next thing I know, I see a story in the news that they've been arrested, tried, and they're going back to prison again and again and again. It's so absurd that we think we're solving anything. We're not.
Absolutely correct. You know, I have, you know, personal experiences with people that I know that describe exactly what you're saying. You know, go to prison for 5 years because you're on drugs and you committed other crimes in the process. Of course, because Oregon has the mandatory sentencing laws in place so that, you know, for various, what I think it's like 23 crimes or something, have mandatory sentences. And so, you know, if that's imposed on you, then, you know, the minimum is 5 years. For a first offense and then a second offense, then you'll get like 7 years depending on the crime, whatever. But in any case, you know, so after 5 years of prison for committing crimes while doing crack cocaine, gets out of prison is only good for a little over a year, then starts doing the same shit again, and ends up right back in prison again. And it's just, it's exactly like you said, because the core issue was never really resolved. Something triggered, be willing to give up, potentially give up another 5 years or more of their lives for that drug. That's how addicted it is, addictive they are, you know? And that's amazing to me. I mean, you would think 5 years in prison would be enough to have somebody go, yeah, I never want to touch that shit again, and never do it. But guess what? It happens all the time. They still do. You know what I mean? It blows my mind, you know, that somebody would even risk that. But that's how powerful addiction is.
Absolutely. It's not about intellect. It's not about common sense. It's not about weighing the good and the bad. When an addict gets triggered, in 99% of the cases, when they get triggered, they cannot help themselves. They're going to use. And it's just such a shame that the current model is such an utter and complete failure. And it doesn't really take that into the reality of the addictive personality. It really doesn't take that into account. Now, I know some people who may have gone to substance abuse counseling will be screaming at their computers or their phones that I'm wrong. What I mean by they don't actually take stock of it is it's not countered. It's not effectively dealt with. People come out of that kind of counseling, especially if they get it in jail, they come out of it with this false idea that they're good. And, you know, I've heard their rap, right? You know, oh, no, you know, I can't do anything. You know, if I do the slightest thing, I'm going to, you know, collapse and go back into that habit before, you know, again, you know, I get it. I understand. And I know where I need to be. And they got this whole thing going on. And then 5 months later, I see that they were arrested again for using meth or whatever their drug of choice is. So we're not effectively dealing with it. I'm not saying it's never addressed. It just isn't effectively being dealt with.
Absolutely. Okay. So in the chat room, I think we have some antsy pantses. I did want to talk about Measure 114. Maybe we can get into that after we do some Q&A. But I think we have several people that are on the switchboard raising their hands that want to comment or ask questions. Sure, absolutely.
Okay. I was under the impression that we were going to do 2 hours today, not three. So I have another commitment. I can give you maybe another 10 minutes. I apologize if I misunderstood. I thought we were no longer doing 3 hours. We were doing 2 hours.
I was hoping that, because my show went to a 2-hour live, but then the bonus hour. And so I was hoping that I'd be on with you, you know, through the bonus hour and the whole show recording part. So I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear in my emails to you as well. So I get it if you have prior commitments. So why don't I do this? Since we only have a short amount of time with you, I'll try to bring on whoever I can that's on the switchboard just for a really quick Q&A. I know Mike is one person. He's one of my listeners that has asked about you, and so I want to give Mike a quick chance to give you any questions or comments. Try to keep it short, Mike, since we're kind of down to the wire. So I'm bringing you on, Mike.
All right.
Hey, Mike, do you have a question or comment?
Yeah. My thing is, back when the whole thing with Hunter Biden and his, quote, tax problems, well, you talked about foreign-derived income, quote, income. Well, that's what we're talking about with Hunter Biden and his, quote, income. Most of it is foreign derived. He should be taxed, right?
No. If you heard what I said a U.S. citizen residing abroad with foreign earned income. And in tax law, what it means to reside somewhere is that you retain your domicile. Again, in law, what domicile means is the place you consider home and that place to which you will be returning. Residency is a place that you live temporarily with the intention of returning to your domicile. So, for instance, I'm domiciled in Nevada. If I were to become a resident of Germany with the intention of returning to my home in Nevada, and I were to earn German income and send it back across the border into the United States, then I would owe the tax. But to my knowledge, and I don't know enough about Hunter Biden to say one way or another, but to my knowledge, Hunter Biden was not living abroad. At all times, he was living in the United States. So that third class would not apply to him.
Actually, he was living at one point in Ukraine at one point.
Visiting or
so,
living?
Yeah. Living in Ukraine.
So he was
– because he was
– so
yeah,
he worked at that
oil company in Ukraine, yeah.
Okay, now he was a consultant to them. He was just sitting on their board. He wasn't employed, and I've never heard that to be a resident there are certain requirements. I'll look into it, but I've never heard that he was a Ukrainian resident. I don't believe that's accurate.
And right, and one other thing I want to say about words meaning things in respect to taxes. Must and shall. Must means you have to do it. You have no choice but to do it. Shall means you have a choice. I'll give you an example. We just repassed recently a school maintenance tax for our parish, our public school parish. And that tax, it says you must pay that tax. Everybody in the parish must pay that tax, even though everybody in the parish doesn't take advantage of the facilities because a lot of people send them to the away to school or to the local Catholic school, private school. So that's what they do. They change the meaning of the word must and shall, you know.
Okay. I believe the distinction is actually between may and shall.
May and shall. Yeah, that is in my mind, it's the same thing because may means you have to, shall means you don't. You know.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to again, since we're very short on time, we have Daniel and Kathy raising their hand. I'm going to go ahead and bring them on. Hopefully keep it short. Daniel, Kathy, you're on the line. Do you have a question or comment for Dave Champion? Are you there?
Ooh.
All right, moving on. Boyd, I'm going to bring you on next. Boyd is from Alaska. Same with you. Do you have a
Dave.
Question or comment for Dave Champion real quick?
Yeah, I got a question regarding all the illegal aliens that have just crossed the border and are receiving benefits from the United States government, and they are sending money back to home to their families. Is that money taxable when it crosses the border, leaving the United States?
Yes. If they're here, well, it depends, because the definition of a non-resident alien is somebody who either doesn't live in this country or is within the country for less than 181 days. So if they're here for more than 181 days, then we begin to get into issues between definitions for non-resident alien within the tax code versus definitions for Title VIII, Immigration and Naturalization. And I haven't looked at the differences or attempted to reconcile them. But yes, if somebody's in this country for less than living here for less than 181 days and they're receiving U.S. source income, when it crosses the U.S. border, yes, the U.S. income tax has to be paid. Now, do I know that these people who are receiving U.S. financial aid, do I know that they're not filing tax returns? Because if they are filing tax returns, they're paying the tax.
Well, they are paying the tax that they have are obligated to pay because it's here. But once it goes across the border and crosses the border, isn't it subject to another tax of income?
No.
Tax of some type?
Once they file their income tax return and they pay what they owe the federal government in income tax, the remainder that they have is called post-tax income. That is not subject to any further taxation, and they can do anything they want with it. They can send it across the globe. They can burn it in a trash can. They can go out and spend it on a Rolex watch. They can do whatever they want if it's post-tax money. There's no other tax hiding in the wings. Once they pay their income tax, it's done.
Okay. Now, if I'm not mistaken, most of our welfare recipients, be it foreign alien, illegal alien, or U.S. citizen, because of the amounts of money that they are getting, it's not taxable per se. So even if these, like these illegal aliens, are receiving aid and money from the U.S. government, okay, but they're under the tax cap, taxable income, and they send their money home, isn't it still then taxable?
No. If they don't meet the filing threshold, they can do whatever they want with the money. It respectfully, it seems like you have a bit of an agenda that you're pushing here. I hear where you're coming from, but that's not what the law says.
Okay. Well, that was my question. And please come back and do another show with this lady. Because
okay.
You covered
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, maybe
of,
we could actually you finally cover, get the
you
firearms.
Covered, you covered a lot of bases here that I would like to have a discussion with you on, but because of time constraints, I will leave it where I'm done with it. So thanks for showing up, Dave.
All right, appreciate it. Thank you for being here.
Awesome, Dave. With respect
to
your time,
more,
do we
Lauren?
Have time for one more? Yeah, we got Joe Gibson raising his hand. He's the last one raising his hand. So I'm going to go ahead and bring him in, and we'll try to keep it short. I appreciate it. All right. Joe Gibson,
How you doing?
Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I'm just going to, well, really quick comment and question in a way. You know, we became subject class citizens after the Reconstruction Act and the 14th Amendment. So, therefore, with the and the creation of the Federal Reserve and the government selling the bonds to the Federal Reserve and then the Federal Reserve printing the money, all these taxes don't pay for the services that we are rendered anyway. It pays the interest for interest. So what's the purpose of the taxes anyway? Why do they have these taxes? I mean, what's the game here? What's the end result game that they're trying to propose to us? I can't pronounce it. I got tongue-tied there. Put upon the burden of the American people.
Oh, that's very simple. It's to pay the interest on the national debt. There's a reason that it was the same Congress in 1913 that passed both the Federal Reserve Act and the Income Tax Act in the same session. And the reason is that the income tax was specifically intended to pay the interest on the national debt. that is part and parcel of the structure of the Federal Reserve System and a fiat currency system and so forth. In order for the bankers, I mean, look, let's say you wanted to take out a loan to buy a new truck. So you go to your bank and you sit down with them. You say, I want to go out and I want to buy a new truck. So I'd like you to make a loan. Oh, and by the way, I'm not going to pay you a penny in interest. The banker would tell you, get the fuck out, right? So the same thing is true with the banks of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve Board is a federal agency. The banks of the Federal Reserve are private banks. If they don't get paid their interest, they aren't going to loan the federal government any money. So the only way the federal government could generate those interest payments, because you can't pay interest out of your capital, right? You have to have some source to pay the interest from. And that's the income tax. It's as simple as that. That is why income tax exists here in 2024 in the United States.
Well, what about the fractional reserve banking that practices where they create this money? Because banks cannot lend out their own reserves. They're not allowed to do that. So they create money. I deposit a $100 check. They recreate that money 9 times, 10 times, 15 times over and lend it out. And it's called fractional reserve banking. Do you understand that, the economics of that? And I know we're pressed for time, so it's kind of hard to ask direct questions concerning such a complex issue. But, fractional reserve banking, basically.
So, yes, I am thoroughly aware of fractional reserve banking and understand it front to back. However, that respectfully has nothing to do with anything we talked about here on the air today.
Well, it has to do with taxes and interest, but that's fine. I understand. Maybe next time we'll have more time, hopefully.
Yeah, that would be great.
Can I slip in one word answer from you, Dave, before you go?
Sure.
Okay. Is the IRS a federal agency or an agency of the Federal Reserve?
It is an agency. I'm sorry. It is a bureau within the Department of Treasury of the United States government.
Okay.
It's right there. You can look it up.
Okay. Okay. All right. That answered my question. Thank you.
Okay. Have a good night.
Well, there we have it. I know we're going over time here.
I've got
some noise in the background. Mute yourself, guys, if you got background noise. Once again, Dave Champion, I have loved having you on my show. Like I said, it just goes by so fast. I mean, when we get to talking and I'm listening, it's just like a time warp, and before you know it, we're out of time. And then once again,
we
get onto topics that we don't get to. So again, thank you for being on my show. And I hope that we can do so again for round 5 sometime in the near future. Hopefully we can have more time for QA than we did this time around, like I intended. So I apologize to all of you out there that wanted to have more QA time. That was my failure, my bad, that I didn't stop the conversation with enough time for good Q&A. So before you go, how are your doggies and kitties? Because you have quite the fur family going on. So how is Scar? How is everybody?
Oh, Scar is his typical loving self. He's so loving. He's almost like a dog, and you know the dogs are great. Yeah, everybody's doing absolutely fantastic. Thank you for asking about them.
Oh, absolutely. How many? Because you got a new addition not too long ago, I think, because you were on on my show last July, and so I think you have a couple new additions to your family.
You know, we patronize a rescue here in our community. And so we'll stop in from time to time. And our philosophy is, you know, if we've been fortunate enough to be able to provide good homes for animals that are in need, we want to do that. So with that philosophy, we have at this time 4 dogs and 7 cats. I think if I were to suggest another one, Jen would shoot me. But we enjoy providing a good home for loving animals. So that's what we do.
And I really appreciate you for that, too, because you, one of your recent, I forget the kitty's name, but it was a feral cat. And
yes, that would be Bella.
That you
be
took
Bella.
In. Yeah, and it took a while for her to kind of warm up, but you know, I saw your post and everything, and I just want to commend you because you're so patient, and you're so, like, willing to give these animals the space that they need to adjust, and it sounds like she's doing really pretty well. You've had some milestones with her coming around to get a little more social between, especially with the dogs. She's a dog kitty.
Yeah.
I understand.
All right. I'm sorry. I have to cut this off or I'm going to be late for another obligation. I apologize.
No problem. No problem. Thank you. I appreciate you taking
Thank
the extra
you so
time.
So much for
I apologize
having me
for...
on.
Always
yeah.
my
we'll,
pleasure.
We'll
put
you and I will talk
sure.
soon. Okay. Thank you, Lorianne.
All
Take
right.
care.
We will do so. Have a great night. Thank you so much. All righty. There we have it. Yeah, I guess we kind of had a little cross communication problem, I think, because, you know, he thought it was, you know, when I said two-hour live show, I think it's confusing because it's like, hey, we're going to be two-hour live, and then we go into this bonus hour thing. But that's probably part of where the confusion lies is because I had explained to him that I went from a three-hour live show to a two-hour, but then we have this bonus hour thing. And anyway, so hopefully we will have a round five with him sometime, and I will have more time to dedicate toward Q&A. But I think we focused a lot on the income tax tonight because it was good timing with, you know, tomorrow being tax filing day. I think it was appropriate that we dedicated a lot of time to talking about the income tax and getting into some more of those nuances. And again, if you're out there, please follow him on Rumble. Invest some time in watching some of his videos on various topics, but especially he talks about body science and the medical community. That's another level of scammery that goes on. I think we all know that in the medical community, especially dietary needs and things. So, you know, it's time well spent if you kind of go and binge watch some of his videos on Rumble. So, everybody else out there, how you doing? We got a few callers. We got a Skype caller. We got Cinnamon, Suzette Robert, and Donnie that have just been hanging back listening. Press one. I'm happy to bring you on in.
Well,
what's on
I wanted
your mind?
To get
what
into.
Do you guys think?
I wanted to get into it with him exactly how the creation of the money is and how I wanted to hear him say it, you know, and acknowledge that fact, where the creation of the money. And then when he said something about, you know, he said the IRS was a part of the Treasury Department. Did he also say that the Federal Reserve Board of Governors was a part of, that they were owned, did he say they were associated with the American government at all? Like as far as like the, like they're a part of the government? I don't know if he did or he didn't.
That's what I understood that he said.
Yeah, well, he's dead wrong. The Federal Reserve is a private offshore banking cartel, central bank that's owned by stockholders that aren't even American. They're so secretive you can't even find their names half the time. So they are have nothing to do with the federal government at all. They're no more federal than Federal Express.
Yeah, we might have to get in more into the nuance of that. The Federal Reserve Board versus the Federal Reserve itself. The Federal Reserve Board is composed of seven members, including a chair appointed by Congress from among the regional Federal Reserve banks. So I guess maybe there's some nuances there on whether or not they are actually part of the federal government or not.
Call them up. See what they say. I bet they'll hang up on you. They won't even talk to you, you know, or try to write them a complaint. They won't even acknowledge you. You're not a part of the government at all. They have nothing to do with it. I called them live on my podcast like 4 years ago. They threatened me. They told me, you don't ever call here. We don't deal with citizens. That's what they told me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we don't deal with citizens. We'll print up the money and everything like that, but we don't have to answer to you. Yeah, that whole deal. But no, that'll be put that, you know, as a feather in your cap.
I think what he said about educating the people. Educating the people, what he said was he's right about educating the people, but we have to educate them the proper way. Like, for instance, the creation of, like, your checking account. What is a checking account? You know, what is a mortgage? How is a mortgage created at that bank? How does all this work? That's what people have to understand, you know, and when we can understand that and understand the crimes that they're committing, then we can kind of try to figure out a plan to try to shut it down. If we don't understand the system and how it works, how can we shut it down or abolish it or you put a new system in when we don't understand this system? We're going to put another system in we don't understand? So we have to understand how it works.
You know,
that's a good point.
To Joe's point, though, when I asked him about the Hunter Biden situation, and he really didn't know a lot about it because from what I understand about it, Hunter Biden did at one point live in Ukraine at one point. So, and a lot of his income does come from China and Ukraine, and that a lot of that income, that the 10% goes to, quote, the big guy, does come from foreign sources. Now, the other part of that I didn't have time to get into is the FARA Act, Foreign Agent Registration Act, which is another way he got in trouble with that because he never registered as a foreign agent. It's okay to be a foreign agent, to lobby the U.S. government on behalf of foreign governments or businesses or whatever. You just have to register as that. And he didn't, and neither did Joe Biden. So,
well,
Joe Biden is a fool. You'll go ahead.
I think when you start going into that stuff, Mike, that gets beyond where his expertise is, okay?
Right.
And you're getting into details that he can't really answer.
Well, at least not readily, not without researching.
Yeah.
He tends to be one of those people, if I haven't really gone into it and researched it myself, he tends to be one that doesn't speak to it, like, confidently. He can be like, well, if it's this or this, then I would guess this. You know, he's usually pretty good about saying what he thinks, what information he does have, versus, you know, he'll be the first to say, I haven't really dug into that. I need to look into the nuances of that act. I need to see what it really says. And, of course, even within that act, you have to look at the definitions, you know, of the terms used in that act. And if that act has its own definition for these terms, or if those terms are defined in some other act somewhere, you know what I mean? And that you have to refer to. And so it's like going down multiple rabbit holes, you know, when we talk about this kind of stuff. But I think that, we had a very definitely a more in-depth conversation about the income tax than we did like the first time around. I'm hoping that he'll come back for number five.
Right, and my thing is the income tax and how it's a scam. You look, I mean, and it goes back to at one point Sean Hannity on his show would say, look, I pay this much, I pay the federal government income tax, I pay the state government income tax, I pay the county tax income tax, I pay I pay the city of New York income tax, right? So he's getting hammered. You know, at one point, he was getting hammered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times as he was living in New York State, you know? You know, and that's how they want it. That's how they get their money, you know. They take multiple bites of the apple, in other words.
Yeah, they're taking their cut, kind of like how we phrased it. You know, they're all taking their cut. And one of the things I wanted to try to get to tonight was talking about Social Security withholding, Medicare withholding, and that sort of thing, and the obligations of that, which maybe I'll put that in my reserve cap for the next time that he's on to hit him up with that. But I know in his book, he talks about Social Security and, you know, how, and he has a good take on it, where when we're talking about Social Security, we've all been, you know, we've been paying into it. It's taken out of our checks. It's supposed to be there for us when we retire. You know, and so many people, you know, say, you know, hey, Social Security isn't an entitlement. This is money that we've paid into. It's our money. But he gets into that in the book, and it's like, well, really? Actually, no, it's not. You know, it's a yet another form of revenue that goes to the Department of Treasury into a general fund, just like any other tax revenue, right? And so that is why it's been abused. You know, like we keep saying that, you know, our government keeps going into the Social Security coffers, you know, and raiding it. And they do, but yet really a separate thing, you know, like we think it is. It's not this separate trust fund like we think of as a trust fund, right? And again, like even in in legislation, when they talk about it, like we have to look at like if they're referring to Social Security as being a trust fund, then how much you want to bet somewhere in the pages and pages and pages of Social Security and their definitions, they've probably completely changed the definition of what a trust fund is for the purposes of the legislation for Social Security, right? And so that's like a whole other another rabbit hole that we have to go down and question.
Lori Ann, you have to, I don't think you're old enough to remember, I think it was back in 64, up until 1964, okay, the Social Security was a trust fund. If it was still a trust fund today, okay, Congress would have to pay back $4 or $5 trillion to Social Security to make it whole again, as it was when it was first set up. It was in 64 that they took the Social Security out of a trust fund and placed it into the general fund because it had so much money in it that they could not keep their hands off of it.
Exactly. It was too big of a pot for them to resist digging into.
They robbed the citizens of the United States right up in front of everybody's face.
And yeah, I wasn't around at that time. That was about, you know, 11 years before or 9 years before I was born when that happened. And yeah, how much you want to bet that when that change was made, that's exactly, you know, how they redefine things.
Most,
you know, like the government could say, yeah, it's still a trust fund, but the thing is back in 1964, did they change the definition of what a trust fund is? You know,
they didn't, like you said, it
went into the general fund instead of its own separate entity.
They didn't change the definition. They just moved it completely. There is no trust fund. There is no trust fund. If there was a trust fund, most people on Social Security right now, and those would only be those parties who paid into Social Security to receive Social Security, their monthly check from Social Security would now be probably a minimum of $10,000 a month.
Exactly. That's why I'm against the whole concept of Social Security. You know, because it's really, you're not, you know, it's really taking away money that you could, if you were truly free and had liberty, that money could be set aside into an actual separate retirement account and gain you a lot more benefits when it comes time to retire. You would be getting a hell of a lot more than what you are getting when you, retire at Social Security age.
There was an attempt made to let everybody paying into Social Security designate half of their Social Security payments going into Social Security to be allowed to be invested in the stock market as an investment. And they just had a conniption fit and to shut that fucker down.
That was the whole argument about, oh, they want to privatize Social Security. That was that argument. And that was the whole thing about, was it Hillary Clinton or was it Al Gore? One of them was talking about this is Social Security, quote, lockbox. I think that was Hillary. I was talking about it at the time. It might not just have been her, but it was somebody that said, use that. You go ahead.
I cannot, Mike, at this point in time, remember who it was, whether it was in the Clinton or the Bush era that those proposals came up. And when they did, the conniption fits that were going on up on the Hill there in D.C. were just amazing.
You know, I think what that was is that was part of the contract with America from
Newt.
From that was the contract with America thing from Newt Gingrich.
No, because every one of his 10 points he had in with the contract with America passed. Yeah, it wasn't contract with America.
Let's see.
Right on. Wow, we only got 20 minutes left before my switchboard will shut down too. So... I'm thinking, since it's in my head, I should unmute those who are in the switchboard unmute them on my end. Otherwise, I'll probably forget in about 19 minutes to do so beforehand. But in case you do want to speak up and do something, I know I got Donnie, we got Suzette Robert, we got Cinnamon, and we got a Skype caller. Mute yourself on your end and just continue to kick back and listen. But I do want to unmute you right now while I'm thinking about it so that you can chime in should you want to. But like I said, in about 18 minutes or so, I will lose the ability to do so. So here we go. I'm bringing on Donnie. Bringing on Suzette Robert. Bringing on Cinny. And then I have a sneaky suspicion that the Skype caller that's been listening might be John Doe. We'll find out at some point. But, yeah, just stay muted on your end. You're all unmuted now in case you do want to chime in. And it looks like Ron Reff is going to be doing a show starting in about 17 minutes as well. So we'll see who sticks around here or if we all make our way over to Ron Reff's show or not. We shall see.
I just put the link for his show in the chat room.
Okay. I just looked it up, boy, and that Social Security lockbox thing happened in the 117th Congress, which was 21 and 22. So, fairly recently. Skype caller, who do we have? Man, we just got quiet.
I know, right? I don't know. Maybe everybody's like going down their own rabbit holes or something, or maybe they're going on to drreality.news to get their copy of Income Tax Shattering the Myth.
Actually, everybody
really likes to get people on that have read his book, and then he'll go more into detail about it.
Everybody's at their damn kitchen table trying to fill out their tax forms.
Yeah, right away.
Yeah, exactly. They're filling out their tax forms to pay the taxes that they know they shouldn't have to pay. But, you know, that's the brilliance of our government is even if you know it doesn't apply to you, the intimidation factor, you know, who wants to open up their lives to the scrutiny of the IRS and have to take additional time out of their lives to go and sit with them and try to educate the people that work at the IRS? That's the other part of the factor, which he did. And has done, but not a lot of us want to open that up. That fear factor is ingrained in us so heavily that even if we know better, you know, we'll still go and do it. Kind of like it's like the same concept as like along the same lines as doing a plea deal. You know, you're afraid of a jury finding you guilty, getting the maximum sentence, which could include prison time, and then have a bunch of fines imposed on you. And then, of course, there's all the court time and everything else. And so even if you know you are not guilty of the crime, you get pressured and coerced into taking a plea deal of pleading guilty so that you can avoid a worse punishment than what you're going to get if you take that plea deal. And the income tax is kind of along those lines with the IRS. You know, if we just comply with what we know, that, you know, we know it's not, we're not subject to it, but we comply anyway because it's a lot less painful to go ahead and file your income tax with IRS and your breakdown of all your income and your deductions and all that kind of stuff. That is easier. And you even get a reward, quote unquote, when you do that, when you get a refund, you know, now not only does it take the fear away by complying, but you'll get rewarded when you overpay for something that it doesn't apply to you anyway, and you'll get some of that money back, right?
Sure.
So it's a lot less painful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and on Donnie's show last night, we were really getting into a lot of discussion about the tax. And we were really kind of it was a really good discussion that was going on Donnie's show in regards to this as well. And we were just like, you know, there was a lot of like da-da-da-da-da going on about it. And I chimed in and I'm like, this is exactly the kind of stuff we'll be talking about on my show too, but because it's in the forefront of our minds. Why are we so afraid of our own government is the big question. You know, this is inherently what's wrong. The government is no longer afraid of us. We're afraid of them. And so we just keep complying and complying and complying with shit that we should never comply with for out of fear and out of intimidation. And with most contracts, if we are coerced and in fear and it's deceptive practices being used to get us to sign a contract, then usually that contract is null and void. You can't sign a contract under duress and under coercion.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But that's exactly
what we're doing with the income tax.
And that's the thing. I give you another good example of that. To get when they took what's her name into that Atlanta jail and booked her, I'm not talking about Sidney Powell. I'm talking about the other lawyer for Trump that was for Trump. That was an intimidation to get her to sign a plea deal. All right, you know. That was an intimidation to get her to sign, because what happened is there was a fight that took place and it scared the shit out of her, you know? And so she said, okay, I'm going to plead. I'm going to take a plea deal.
Oh.
You know? Jenna Ellis, yeah, that's the one I'm thinking about. So that's how they do. They want to use these things to intimidate us into not arguing. In other words, I give you, in terms of the tax situation, when remember the whole kerfuffle when Wesley Snipes got caught for not paying his taxes and he moved away? Well, you know what? He's an American citizen who doesn't earn his money from foreign sources, and he shouldn't have went to jail because he shouldn't have been paying taxes in the first place. No?
Hello, everyone. Hello.
Hello. How are you doing?
Very good. How are you doing, lovely lady? Lovely Lorian.
I'm glad that you were able to call in tonight. I'm doing all right.
Love
I'm actually
guess.
Flipping through some of the Income Tax Shattering the Myth book.
No, he's very knowledgeable. Loved everything you had to say. Want to thank you for bringing him on the show. I hadn't heard him before. And I understand that was your fourth episode with him, so I am upset that I missed the other episodes with him. But I did find him on Rumble. I went directly there, and so I follow him now. And Rob and I were looking at the different titles of the different shows. And
Suzette, I would suggest.
The first two times he was on, he converted that into a Rumble video. Which, of course, is just our picture or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So the first two are on his channel. And then on the show episode for tonight, I put links to the previous three times that he was on, if anybody wants to go back and listen to the past episodes with him. Definitely encourage you to do so. The links are there. So, yeah, but you can also find the first two times on his Rumble channel if you go scrolling back far enough. And I encourage you to, you know, back during the COVID stuff, he did some excellent videos on immunity, on COVID, on the
big pharma,
the scam that it was, the jab. He got into, that's why he got deplatformed off of YouTube and moved everything over to Rumble, because he was talking about that stuff. And of course, that's a no-no, telling the truth about COVID and the COVID jab. Do that.
Yeah.
that kind of thing, yeah.
Heaven forbid the truth be told, you know. what I wanted to say about the Social Security is, well, as far as being under duress to pay taxes, when you sign up for your Social Security card, you do that voluntarily, and they tell you so. In the paperwork, this is voluntary to sign up for Social Security. There are some companies that employ without a Social Security card or number, but most do. And so it's, you know, it's difficult to find those other companies. But once you sign for that Social Security card, you're signing, you know, to become a federal citizen and to all the benefits and non-benefits that it comes with, which is taxation.
Not anymore, Suzette, because
what?
An infant that's born in a hospital has a Social Security card number before they leave the hospital. And that infant didn't sign
cases,
a damn thing.
Right. Well, in some cases, yes, and in some cases, no. I mean, if you don't name your kid, because the kid has to have a name in order for them to sign the number. They did make it a law that or something to that effect, that they would be assigned a Social Security number at birth. I don't know. Something had changed that, though, to where it was still voluntary as far as to get that number and register your kid with the government. Because you have the midwives that deliver babies, and, you know, there's no hospital or registration there. It's up to the parents, you know, which they do automatically because I feel that's what they have to do because the government said so. But that's not so. And also, you know, when you think about the income tax form that you fill out, you have to consider the Fifth Amendment. You're protected to not self-incriminate. And what are you doing when you put down all your finances and the money that you make and, you know, any charities that you donate to, you know, basically everything about you on that document, and then you sign it? You're self-incriminating yourself when you sign it. And so that having that IRS tax code basically nullifies the Fifth Amendment to self-incrimination. I thought that was very interesting when I was reading about that a while back, but I just remembered that, and I forgot about it, and then you guys ended the conversation when you asked if there's any more questions, and I didn't think about it, and then afterwards, oh, shoot, I was going to ask him about that. Because there's a difference.
That always happens with me too. Like, oh yeah, I meant to bring this up, or I meant to bring that up, or man, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I do that all the time.
Which is why
and I should write it down
because it happens every time.
I got to start carrying a pad of paper with me so I can write those things down. But so that would, I wanted to know how that would apply with the state and the federal citizen, because they're with the two different entities. And identifying people today as persons, but persons is an office. It doesn't identify you as flesh and blood. And so anyway, how that all factored in, because it is self-incrimination. And he's right as far as it being the biggest fraud of all. But on that note also, as far as how does that apply, because the constitutional protections, if you're a federal citizen, do not apply. And just like he was saying earlier, he named off the different entities that apply and don't apply. So, and So anyway, that's all. Back to you.
And I will guarantee you, when he was talking about the meaning of employee, Lorianne, that's why these people don't want Trump back in there, because he's going to fire all these federal, quote, he's planning on firing all these, quote, federal employees. They'll lose their jobs. Hello.
Sorry, I was just messaging him, thanking him for being on the show and so on and so forth. So, sorry, I got a little distracted.
Yeah, no. It was interesting.
A woman doesn't get distracted like that.
Yeah, once in a while, you know.
Man, it was interesting, Lorianne, when he got into the meaning of words, like employee, you know, what exactly that word means and how it is applied in these laws, you know, in the tax code. You know, it's like, okay, that means that, you know, these federal, quote, employees should fear Trump because he can, you know, go ahead, boy.
I didn't say nothing.
Were you asking?
I thought boy was going to say something, but. Yeah, the Trump is making a big deal about hiring a lot of these federal employees. And according to what I heard tonight from him, from Dave, he would be well within his rights to do that. And he would have the ability to do that. You know?
And he would be doing them all a favor. Because now, then they won't be required to pay taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but see, remember when we were talking about that, though, it's like there's a difference, like employee, when it comes to who is subject to the income tax, it's not employees that are subject to it. It's income, you know, so the income, so that's like where they get you to, because the income tax is all about defining the criteria or the classes of people that are subject to it. So, and the classes of people that are subject to it aren't employees, right?
Unless they work for a government agency or whatever, and blah, blah, blah.
But it only applies to them if they fit into those categories where the income tax applies to. Yeah.
Yeah. And as a government employee, you're an officer, and an officer is required.
Mm-hmm.
Only if they are one of those four classes of people. If you're a government employee, but you are a U.S. citizen earning income domestically within the United States, that still doesn't apply to you. If you're somebody who's a foreigner that is working in a government agency, so you're a foreigner earning the income here, then it would apply to you, right? Because you're a foreigner, not a U.S. citizen, all that. And then, you know, or your corporation or whatever, you know, so it applies to the corporation. Or, you know, when he was talking about that fourth class where you're liable, so, you know, you're operating on the behalf of a foreign company or a foreign person, investing in a U.S., you know, stock market or company or whatever, then it applies for withholding so that you pay the taxes on the money. But it's, that money's taken out before it leaves the United States and gets sent off to, you know, outside of the country, basically. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting when we start dealing with what do these terms really mean and who does it really apply to. So, you know, when you look at the categories that he describes, you know, the class of people that the income tax applies to, it doesn't necessarily automatically mean that it applies to employees as defined as that is working for a government, you know, government agency or a government department, whatever. You don't have a government, you know, so just because you have a government job and you are an employee as a result, as defined, does not automatically put you in the categories where the income tax applies to. Does that make sense? So, yeah, this is like where we can go around and around and around.
Another way to put it is all state residents hold an office in the state government as a person because they created that entity, but not everyone who's a resident also holds the office of a person. A person is judge, prosecutor, police, like he had named all these people, legislators, administrators, attorneys, blood-sucking attorneys, and bureaucrats.
Exactly. Yeah, it's it's one of those things where, you know, how many of us actually have the time to go and look up and read all of this stuff, and then not just reading it, but comprehending it to the point of knowing when something applies and when it doesn't, when that definition applies and when it doesn't. Like we were getting into, it just depends. You know, that I like how he pointed out, what was the word that he said when it comes to legal definitions? He came up with like 40 different definitions depending on what law you're reading. And so that one word can have so many multiple definitions depending on what legislation you're referring to and how you're applying it.
Mm-hmm. I know, yeah, that's very true, especially that's why they talk about lawyers and speaking legalese. That's that legalese jargon that ordinary citizens, unless we went to school, wouldn't know the meaning for that particular or the definition for that particular case, or that it required a meaning, specific meaning to the precedent case that they're using to defend or prosecute. So, yeah, it'll make your head blow up. And me, I'm home all the time, so that's all I do is read. I didn't have as much time to read, so I would kind of just summarize a lot of it as far as immediately go to the end of the book and get the ending and kind of figure out the rest. But now it's
all I do is read.
If you're
a kid and you're in high school here in Oregon, and you know, Oregon doesn't even require you to have sufficient reading comprehension skills anymore.
What?
How self-serving is that?
Oh,
you know,
my
yeah,
gosh.
Until 2028. Because it's racist.
Wow.
Same with math. So
math
and
math
reading
thing,
comprehension are no longer high school requirements in Oregon. And they have until 2028 to figure that out because it's apparently racist.
Oh, good
to require that.
Yeah, I heard about the math, but I didn't know about the reading comprehension. I shouldn't be surprised, but wow, these kids. Rob and I were listening to a show, and the host was reading the comments, and her name is Dana, and somebody in her chat room had put Dana Rude, and it was like, Dana Rude? What's Dana Rude? Oh, Dana's rude, because she had said something to her guest or whatever, so they were saying she was rude. But they left out the S, you know, Dana's rude. Who's rude? The person. And it just went, Dana rude. So I was thinking, oh no, I mean, our society hasn't been that dumbed down, has it? Really? We're leaving out words, you know, in sentences, not even whole sentences. Wow.
Yeah, forget about punctuation, too. We don't need punctuation anymore. Oh, and if you're dealing with, you know, a younger person, don't you dare use two spaces in between sentences.
No.
That's offensive.
Well, I feel like a genius then compared to these youngsters, you know, and I'm not that smart. But if, yeah, no punctuation. Well, I'm just thinking just in general, just structuring a sentence, even without the proper punctuation. But I guess that's not even possible these days either.
Well, how easy is it to use punctuation in a text message?
Pretty easy. Down by your space bar, you have a comma and a period. That's generally what you need.
Not on mine.
By your space bar down at the bottom, your virtual space bar on your phone, it should be.
In messages?
Yeah,
nope.
In text messaging area, you have your virtual keyboard to where you have all the letters and stuff on there. Numbers up on top.
For me to go to get the punctuations, I have to hit the numbers button next to my space bar to go find the punctuation mark that I want, push it, and then I have to hit back to the text keyboard to continue my messaging.
Oh.
That's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, it is. Most phones will just have the comma and the period on one side. I see the period is on the left side
phone,
and the comma's on the right side. So I have a blue view two or something like that. But I have to hit the numbers button or whatever too to get to the other punctuations like the question mark and the exclamation mark. So yeah, I do have that function that you're talking about with your phone. But
I got an iPhone and there is no punctuations on the keyboard that comes up for me to text from.
Do you text manually with your fingers
or do you use
the audio? Audio text.
I kind of use both.
Okay. Yeah, you can also just tell a question mark at the end of your, you know, whatever you're done. Da 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 question mark. Da 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 exclamation mark. And it'll put it in there. So you don't have to type if you're voice type or texting. So keep that in mind. Or
I only have the period available. But then you can also use different keyboards too. You know, there's the default, you know, that comes with your Android or your iOS. And then, like, I have an option to use the LG keyboard because I have an LG phone. And then you can go to the App Store and you can download different keyboards that have different layouts. And you can set that to use as your default as well. That would hopefully include more of the punctuations. And then there's a size thing, too. Like, if you size your keyboard down, because, like, I know on my phone I sized it down smaller because the keyboard took up, you know, like more than half the space. So I sized it down. And when I sized it down, then that's when it took out some of those extra things like the comma, you know, some of those extra punctuation marks. So it took that down because I reduced the size of it and couldn't fit it anymore.
I got a smartphone with a dumb operator, so I don't use punctuations anymore. I don't use punctuations anymore.
Well, that's not unusual. A lot of people don't.
So you just have it all like a run-on sentence?
Yeah.
I received text like that. There's like big old long text, you know, even continued text words. There's another part of it. Without any punctuation, it's all run together. I'm like, oh, I hate these texts. Because as far as reading it goes, it's like, oh, on and on and on and on and on. What? Wait a minute. Wait, that doesn't make sense. How does that have to? Okay, let me go back and read that. Okay, so they're two different things, two different subjects. There was just no break. That's crazy. Go on.
And then talk about, like, when you, you know, Boyd, you just said, you know, I have a smartphone with a dumb operator. Well, that's where we have to get into, well, what does smart mean when it comes to technology? What does that word mean? It doesn't mean what you think it means. It means self-monitoring, analysis, and reporting technology. That's what it means.
Uh-huh.
It has, yep. It has nothing to do with actual intelligence.
That's true. That's
self-monitoring, analysis, and reporting technology. That's what smart means when we're using our smartphone or our smart washer and dryer or smart TV.
Yeah. They report, all right. They report stuff that don't need to be reporting.
Yeah, it is the technology that uses artificial intelligence, machine learning, and big data analysis to provide cognitive awareness to objects that were in the past considered inanimate.
They still are.
I know, my phone doesn't just jump around on its own. It's still inanimate, you know. It's, my phone